Welcome to the Thursday, September 9th meeting of the Joint Powers. And let the record show that all council members are present. Mr. Enns?
Cayucas is missing Hal Fons for this evening.
Is the city in a position to produce reclaimed water? The city is capable to reuse the water. But the city has no infrastructure in this, has no market in this, and has no way to deliver it to anyone. On top of that, the water contains high chlorides and is bad for crops. So will the farmer pay for this? Does the farmer pay for the process of cleaning this water and the piping and everything, or is that us, the taxpayer? Cost burden on the ratepayer, charging them more to clean the water that you can't do anything with and put it in the ocean. It's already... The water that's put into the ocean has had no environmental impact. We've been on the ocean on the bottom there. There's more sand dollars. There's more halibut. There's more everything where the outfall line is than anywhere. Not doing any problem to anywhere. Then along comes PERC. Hey, PERC promises huge savings, $10 million. They're designed, build, operate, finance, privatizing the operation of the plant. Has there been discussion about privatizing the plant? Is it in the best interest of our city to privatize the plant? Is council ready to resource $30 million? Would he put out another RFP? You know, we all live here in Cayucas and Morro Bay because of the quality of life. We all want to do what's right for the planet. We don't want to put a bunch of crap in the ocean. But what is the deal is the sewer plant has run fine for over 20 years, has never had a citation, has never had any problems, and now the city wants to... I don't know whether it's the state wanting the city to make this water Title 20 use reuse, but there's no infrastructure for it. There's no way to deliver it, and there's no market. So you tell us, why should the ratepayer be liable for putting the piping in? The farmers are not going to do it. Farmers are belly up. So the current power cost is $120,000 for primary and secondary treatment. Oxditch power cost is about $150,000 with secondary treatment, which is required by the law. And then the going green isn't necessarily going green because it takes three or four times the power to clean this water to make it, what, to put it back in the ocean? And the water we're already put in the ocean is already okay. I mean, everything's, you go on the bottom of the ocean out there, there's sand dollars, there's halibut. It's not killing anything, which the EPA and RWQCB say it's fine. So this reclaimed water Title 22 reuse is somewhat of a joke. If you had a market and you had a way to distribute it to everybody, that'd be great. But we have none of that. And the state's not going to pay for it. And us working people that live here and are going to be here for another 20 years, what do you, you know, we're not going to be able to pay for it. Everybody's just hanging on. So I don't know. It's up to you guys. I think that to make the best decision for the city at this time and for the people who are going to live here for another 20 or 25 years, you know, I don't think the city is going to sole source a contract for $30 million. So that's my sentiment. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Bill Martini. And, yeah, for about the last year or two, I've been kind of on the opposite side as far as talking about the reuse of the water. I have talked to some of the ranchers and farmers. They are willing to pay for the water. The delivery system is available. There are several different means to get it out to the farmers. One of the means would be the existing pipeline. It exists 3 miles out. You get an easement. It's a 24-inch water line that goes up to the top of the avocado groves 3 miles out. The other option is to take it to the edge of town and let the farmers take it from there. You're talking purple pipe that could cost three-quarters to $850,000 a mile. I talked to a rancher that put in two-thirds of a mile of the same type of water delivery system for $8,000 to $10,000. So, I mean, there's something out of miss here. And if the problem is the cost of the pipeline going out, maybe talk to the farmers. If they can do it for, you know, $10,000 a mile or whatever, and it's on their own private property, That would solve the cost issue. The biggest problem is the farmers have superior water rights to the city of Morro Bay. They are on the edge of overdrafting the aquifer out there. If that aquifer gets used up, Morro Bay's wells are useless because their water rights are superior. That is really where the value lies. And as far as another option, your well field has nitrates in it now. You have an existing water line from your well field into the city. How about reversing that pipeline to recharge that basin? That infrastructure is in right now where you could use that same pipeline when you're not using that well field. You have a company that can actually deliver reclaimed water for less than what the present proposal is, $5, $10 million less. You are actually getting an added benefit that the permitting process is going to require it anyway. So wait until both of the proposals come in. Truly dollars and cents, which is a better product? But as far as the delivery system of the water, it's there, it's available, it's not that costly, and there is a demand for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Yes. Good evening, Madam Mayor, members of the board, city council members. My name is John Barta, and I wanted to emphasize something that you know, we're all interested in clean water. Really, I believe every person in this room wants to do the right thing for the environment and have clean water. But there's other aspects to a project this large. And as a little demonstration, I brought you, this is 700 pages. This is, you know, 700 pages. This is what the contract that PERC has with Santa Paula is, 700 pages long. And I don't know if there's anybody in this room, okay, I mean, I know there's at least one other member of the bar in here. I'm a retired attorney, and I used to do contract negotiations. But I will tell you that a 700-page contract is the devil's workshop. It's lifetime employment for the attorneys that write it and that interpret it and that end up in litigation over it. It's a real issue. I'm not saying that you can't have good 700-page contracts, but I'm saying it's a big deal when you enter into an agreement that's 700 pages long. And beyond that, there's financing. You know, you can say a price today, but then if you say that price with a certain amount of interest added to it, the total value out the back end can be so high that it bears no relation to the original price. So what I'm suggesting is that whatever you look at and whatever you think about doing, that you do, for lack of a better term, a really deep forensic financial analysis of what it means. Are you going to be able to borrow money against this facility somewhere down the road? Can you refinance the bonds? Or are you stuck with a no prepayment penalty kind of situation? I mean, these are big, big, huge numbers that can be involved in this kind of thing. I can sell you a car today for $10,000. I'll lease you a car today for $10,000 if you promise to pay me at 10% interest. Now, if you took that same $10,000 and put it in treasury bills, one-year treasury bills, you get 1.5% interest. So my profit, the price doesn't matter. I mean, the price matters, of course, but it's not just the price. It's what it costs you for that price down the road. And it's a big thing, and it takes real serious analysis to do that, and it takes real serious skill sets to have people that can do that. And I think that, and anything that you, and how is this going to tie your hands down the road? You know, you want to do the right thing. 15 years from now, it's the opportunity to add something, add recycling, okay? Will you be able to refinance to do that? Can you take those bonds and pay them off and get, you know, and then have the income there? Will you have the security for a further indebtedness? These are all questions that have to be answered. And there, believe me, there's layers and layers and layers of these kinds of questions. So I urge you to not just look and get hung up on the quality of the water, although we all want it to be the best, but you also have to look at the financial implications and what that means for future planning down the road in the city of Morro Bay and in Cayucos. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Yep. I guess I won. Good evening. My name is Bill Yates. Hello, everyone. I think this joint board is doing a great job. We have a process here. There's 10 of you here that are charged with the responsibility of coming up, picking contractors, designers, project managers. You have been elected by the people. Majority rules. You take votes. Majority rules. We have another situation going on in town now where the majority of you have chosen a path and a small minority of town has decided they're not happy with it. And it's reminiscent of the Duke plant where we, the citizens, voted on two measures the same year. One was, shall we require a vote of the people before any modernization happens down there? And the citizens voted no. And shall we move forward with the modernization? And the citizens voted yes. Well, the proponents of the first measure didn't like the way it turned out, and they fought it, and you know, we ended up with no power plant modernization plan down there. We also voted for state water, which I hear in relation to this, which has nothing to do with Cayucas, but it certainly does to us. We voted for state water. The citizens of Morro Bay took a vote, and we voted to bring it in, and we voted that that's one of our water sources. $10,000-$15,000. Out of the $2,050,000, that's a pretty minuscule amount. So the argument, did I lose the sound? The argument that it would save us money on our state water really isn't there. I think the behavior of what's happening right now, the charges, the newspaper articles, the letters, the unsubstantiated, you know, charges of cronyism, one of our staff members' characters basically getting assassinated for somebody he worked for a few years ago that, you know, okay, thank you, Mayor. I think it's very sad. Corruption, there's twisted facts, there's outright falsehoods happening. I would hope that this dialogue can happen in a more respectful manner, that we don't have to be slinging mud at one another. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you for your patience with me.
I wasn't going to speak, but I have something that came up now.
Could you give us your name, please?
Oh, yes. My name is Ann Reeves, and I live in Morro Bay. It has been my observation that voices of the people of this city who pay the taxes, who elect you people, who pay the salaries of the staff, have come and asked you respectfully over and over again to seek other solutions or compare other solutions. And my feeling is that you don't want to hear us. It's set in stone. And I don't like that feeling, so show me that that's not true. Thank you.
Thank you.
Too bad. Honorable friends and staff, Joey Ricano with the California Ocean Outfall Group, and we had come to this area to stop the 301H waiver back in the mid-2000s. At one point, we went to Los Osos to work on the sewer issue there. We ran into big problems, and the seeming corruption was more than just an illusion, my friends. And Montgomery Watson Harza was in the middle of it. And my mom lived in Cape Coral. There were big problems with Montgomery Watson Harza in Cape Coral, Florida. There were big problems with Montgomery Watson Harza in Louisiana. When Dylan Wade says that he has no conflict of interest because he has no financial conflict of interest, that is only half the story. There are two types of conflicts of interest in projects such as these. The first half of them are conflicts that are financial, bribes, kickbacks, etc. And there may be none of those. However, what there are there are his being on a vetting committee and being on the staff that makes the decision. Then there's the having been a Montgomery Watson Harza employee recently on another shady project. And the legal terminology for these, for future use, are divided loyalties and incompatible activities. And those are two very important statements that you need to hold on to as we look closer into this and find out why Morro Bay is about to get mugged by the same people their neighbors just recently got mugged by. A stop has got to be put to it, and we need to find a better solution to our water woes. And I thank you for this opportunity to address you today.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Judy Newman. I'm a resident of Morro Bay. And I first of all want to thank all of you who provide this important public service in your own time. But I want to say that when I became aware of the fact that this enormous project was taking place and that it was being done or being considered as a sole source contract, I was really appalled. I can't imagine that for the money that you were intending to spend, there would not be more public opportunity for input. I'm very sorry that tonight we don't get to talk about the project manager position until after your discussion. I think that some of the things that are important are it doesn't really matter to me at this point whether you were in the mind of selecting either one of the proposed project opportunities. What really matters is that there is a full and open discussion and that we have a side-by-side comparison of what you're buying with each of those contracts. And right now, I don't think that we, the community, know that. We ultimately are going to pay for it. We ultimately are responsible for you and your...
Now, we're expelling about 3 acre feet of water into the ocean. After this plant is built, I understand we'll be doing about the same thing, except there will be a little higher quality water, but it still goes out in the ocean. I think what we have to look at is, after this expenditure, what would the incremental cost be to make this water available for agriculture, and what that additional water would mean in terms of the economy of the county and the state of California? This is an availability of fresh water, and I've never known since I've been in agriculture since 1950, there's been a body of fresh water that hasn't been tapped. And the pipes are incidental to it. It has to do with the fact that this water is available. You have that the soil, the climate, the market for the... All the things we raise over here have no subsidy. These are special crops. No governmental subsidy if it has to have to do with avocados or any of the other crops that are being grown in this amazing climate. The other thing that I'd like to have you kind of ponder, because it came up in the course of our thinking about loss of control. And this is pretty important. I think it should be a major consideration. But my experience has been in terms of dealing with contractors and dealing with the public sector government is what success I've had in pursuing remedy dealing with the public body, which are fine. They're good people. They're elected. They appoint good people with them. However, when it comes to satisfaction of getting results, I've had a lot of better trouble, a lot less trouble, I'd say, dealing with private contractors. And there is an old saying that probably we all know, go sue City Hall. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, David Nelson, resident of Morro Bay. I have to agree with our farmer friend here. The main thing, other than the cost, I mean, I've seen and I've done a little bit of research on it. I'm not an expert, but, you know, comparing the two plants that we're looking at, and I didn't see a whole lot of public input into the replace what we have with what we already have idea and dump the water out. I've heard that if we want to reclaim the water to send it back out to the farmers with the trench system, it's going to cost $6 million. I heard people tell me that their plant's going to give us water right out the top of the thing that's ready to go out in purple lines. They're going to charge us $20 million less. If you guys are buying something for your business and it had a track record, which PERC does, I mean, it isn't a 50-year track record, but let's face it, I've heard people say that plant wasn't doing any any problem to the environment. Well, excuse me, that's why we had a waiver. The rest of the country, a lot of people stand up here and say things that just can't be substantiated, but they sound good to people. It's easy to understand that there's no problem there, but there is a problem. Everybody up here knows you've all worked with the regulators. There is a problem. It's easy to tell people that, oh, these people, and I'm one of those people that will stand up against what's wrong. And this is wrong. I mean, we have a better solution. PERC is guaranteeing this stuff. They're guaranteeing my rates for the sewer for the next 50 years or 30 years, whatever the sewer plan is. And a 700-page contract, what is that? I had 100,000 pages from the Duke project. So 700 pages is not all that crazy in a deal that's going to go this long. I think it's probably careful, and you can ask other people that have it. That's what's blowing me away, is why aren't you people talking to Santa Paula or going even further back to the people who already have perks and they've been running for years? Now, if they don't work, tell the public they don't work and show us. Because what I've been getting is stonewalled by, no, this is the direction we're going in, and that's, we're not going to change because we've got contracts out. Well, the contracts we have out are pretty pathetic, and we're going to be dumping water back in that ocean, and people like me are going to be fighting the city down the road to stop it, because you got to stop it. It's, as he says, you're not going to make any more water, and our water situation is really desperate here. And to say that it doesn't pay back, you can go to San Diego, you can go to Carlsbad, you can go to any number of communities that have purple lines, and they'll tell you damn straight they'll pay back. And there's scales that'll show you they pay back. And if I'm wrong, show me the scales that say they're not going to pay back. And show me why PERC doesn't work. I know that there's other sewer systems that I've seen presented to Los Osos in years past. So show me why the trench system is better than a PERC system, and I'll shut up, I'll go away, and let you guys have your way. But don't do the wrong thing, and that's the wrong thing.
Reduction of biosolids by at least 75% through the use of low-pressure collection systems, which will lower cost and energy consumption by reducing our community's hauling cost, air quality impacts, and traffic. Additionally, low-pressure collection reduces infiltration and inflow, as well as exfiltration. Surf Rider also endorses ponding systems for their low energy consumption, low cost, and the ability to reduce further sludge. Water monitoring. A strong monitoring program is an important part of any management plan and will provide clear data that is vital to maintaining quality, tracking potential problems, and controlling cost. Inclusion of an educational component partnering with local schools, community groups, and nonprofits will help achieve this aspect of the water management plan. No ocean outfall. Dumping 1 million gallons of fresh water a day into the ocean is no longer acceptable or practical. In order to continue making withdrawals from our water bank, we need to start making some deposits to replenish the balance, especially considering the high cost we are paying for water now. The use of tertiary treatment, water recycling, and minimal reliance on chemicals is necessary to preserve our marine ecosystem, the local watershed, and the high water quality we are accustomed to on the Central Coast. This all contributes to lower costs also for both the short term and the long term. Please accept these and other suggestions in our key environmental impact statement on behalf of Surf Rider, a nonprofit environmental organization dedicated to the protection and enjoyment of the world's waves, oceans, and beaches for all people through conservation activism, research, and education. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Greg Crowell, Morro Bay. Hello, everybody. Montgomery Hazard, other people in this audience keep trying to compare apples to apples. Well, this is not an apples to apples situation. We have one, what would be an apple, to another apple, a complete product that will guarantee a price. We have another apple who says they're an apple, but they are not a complete product with an open-ended, unwritten check. That if they follow Fillmore's example, they will go over by $50 million to the city of Morro Bay. That's not apples to apples. Somebody else complained about letters being written and not having their facts. Well, the people that are complaining about not having their facts correct need to check their facts, because every fact was checked in every letter that has been written. So know what you're talking about when you start trying to slam somebody else, because come from truth. This has all got to be from truth. There was also the issue, well, we already have enough water, or we may have enough water. Write this down. Everybody watch the movie Blue Gold. It's all about waters of the world. And it says, the water experts say, that when you take water from one region and you put it in another region, that region has lost that water forever. So they've been draining some of the Great Lakes to sell the water. The Great Lakes are going down. That water is gone from the Great Lakes forever because we're drinking it out here in California in little plastic bottles, paying $2.50 a bottle. We cannot continue to just move waters around the world. So the water is not supposed to all go back into the ocean. We are supposed to reserve some of it on land for our use. So when you start looking at apples and apples, there is no such thing in this issue. So please don't listen to apples for apples. It's just not even possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Good evening. My name is Chuck Cicinia. I'm a resident of Los Osos, a member of the Board of Directors of Los Osos Community Services District. I'd like to share a little of my experience there, as well as the decades I've spent working for a large governmental entity that deals with a lot of different consultant contracts, a variety of consultants. Perhaps it's the luxury of working for that larger outfit and the many different consultants you get to work with, which allow you to see that there are good consultants, there are bad consultants. There are consultants that are good for a while, and then they turn bad just because of different staff, personnel, whatever. The beauty is that you get to develop some sort of insulation. You're not dependent upon a consultant time after time after time. What I see working in a small governmental entity is that you get relationships developed, where the relationship becomes more important than the product you're getting, just because of comfort. And I would recommend that you be very wary of that, particularly with the consultant that you're thinking about. We will never know if the problems that happened back east happened in Los Osos because of the break-in in which all the Montgomery Watson Harza computers disappeared from Los Osos. But we do know that when the 2000...
Good evening, Board. Pleasure to be here again. Steve Owen with PERC Water. Just wanted to stand and let everyone know we're working and have quite a bit invested in this opportunity up here. We have successfully designed now two facilities, a hybrid SBR and a hybrid and an MBR facility for our CDRs that we will be delivering. Been coordinating with staff. Everything's moving along. We anticipate being able to sit down with them in the coming weeks and hopefully make a presentation here to the JPA board at the next JPA meeting in October. I would add, after hearing some of the comments this evening, it's interesting. I can assure you that water quality is important, and if you can save money and still have higher water quality, we would implore you to do that. Some of the comments that were made, well, you know, there's not a purple pipe in place, and that's true today. But 5 years from now, there may be plenty of farmers willing to use that water. And I just want to clarify on some of the comments about bonds and things being paid off. That's not going to be the case. There are JPA or the city, Cayucos, is not going to go out and sell bonds. We are bringing 100% of the funding and financing to the table. So there won't be any bonds to have to worry about going and paying off. You will have the potential, if you want, to buy back the project at any time during the 20, 30-year period under a DBOF model. So that will be available to you. We're also going to give pricing on just DBO or DB alone. And those options will be all available to you and very transparent. the 700-page contract, if I had more time, would separate out. There is the contract, and then there, yes, are quite a few appendices that support the contract. So that didn't get clarified real well. Maybe we could ask this gentleman to go through that and pull out just the contract. But the 700 pages is a little bit, you know, misleading. And whether it doesn't matter, 700 pages in a contract that's going for a 30-year period, quite frankly, is a pretty small contract. Fillmore's RFP that they put out on the street was well over 300 pages just for the RFP. That's what I would call onerous. And so whether whatever side of the fence you're on, all we're saying is, look, here's another alternative. This is something that you should look at. We think we can save the citizens here and the ratepayers a lot of money. We have been in this now for into the 60 days, and we're wrapping up. And I'll tell you, your site is a tough site. You've got some very extreme challenges, and it incurs costs. But
thank you.
But we'll be delivering that soon.
Okay. That all now? Okay. We'll bring it back to council and the board. I'm going to just say one thing about some of the comments. If you haven't heard about this project by now, it's because you're new to town, or you haven't been watching Channel 20, or you haven't been reading the paper, because I've been working on this project for about 10 years on this board. So it's been discussed constantly, continually, every single meeting. That's what we've been working towards. So I'm sorry that you haven't gotten that information, but it has certainly been out there. As far as listening to another alternative, we've got two tracks going. That's already been done. We're looking at two separate tracks. So I'm not quite sure why everybody is still pushing those particular issues. But anyway, any other comments on comments? Okay, then we'll move on. Our consent agenda.
Actually, Ms. Peters, you mind if I make my announcement?
Oh, yes, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Just wanted to invite the public out. We've been accepted to tour both the Santa Paula facility, which is PERC's latest project, and also the Pismo Beach facility, which is fairly new as well. And we just completed the first round of those tours, and they're both very interesting, very appreciative of the operators at both those plants. And I just wanted to extend the invitation to anyone who is interested to come out and attend with our Pismo plant tour coming up September 19th, that's Sunday, from 1 to 3. And then September 26th, we're going to be going down to Santa Paula just outside of Ventura, also a Sunday from 1 to 3. And if you're interested in a carpool, you can contact me directly at 772-7668.
Okay, thank you. All right, our consent calendar. We're going to
just one time, my name is misspelled, but that's all right.
Okay.
So with those corrections, I'd move approval of the minutes of A2.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None.
Same motion. Motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries.
All right. And Betty, A3.
A3 is the report that Mr. Keough, the plant director, manager, gives to us. And I have a couple of questions about events that happened. One is in July, Mr. Keough, and it talks about the cone penetration testing that happened. Is that part of the EIR testing, or is that something separate? And when do we see the results of that test?
The CPT testing is part of the geotechnical investigation that's ongoing for design. Mm-hmm. And based on what they found off the CPTs, they've actually come back out and done some borings at the plant, I guess, so they can sample the soil at certain locations and get a better idea of what they're looking at. I'm thinking mid-October is when the geotech report comes out, and I'm not sure how that gets translated back to the board. But I do know that in the scope of work or in the schedule, they are supposed to deliver something in October.
Okay. So this is about the design. It's not about the EIR, and it will affect the design that we approve later.
I believe they're going to use whatever they learn in that geotech investigation to assist in their the structural engineering.
Okay, thank you. And then I just have a question about the flow chart that's at the back of that report. There is no page number, but it's the last page in that report. And I'm noticing the flows, and we can see here that how it peaks in the winter because of the infiltration type of thing. Could you tell me, I know that we've been collecting money to upgrade our collection system. Will that take care of some of that peak flowing before we get our plant in, so we will not have to build a plant that's higher than it needs to be? Because I heard that we've upgraded the flow results, that we're building a larger plant than we originally said. And so I'm wondering if that can be addressed to some degree by the infiltration fixes that could be going on between now and when the plant's online.
I guess there's a couple answers to that question. The first is that in terms of building a bigger plant, I think if you look at Amendment Number 2, and Steve can correct me if I'm, Mr. Hyland can correct me if I'm wrong, the peak seasonal flow, actually the actual, the daily and the monthly design flows didn't really change. Mm-hmm. It was more the wet weather events. Mm-hmm. And the biggest reason that those changed is because we looked at a longer period of history. Mm-hmm. And when Corolla did their study, they had some fairly good reasons for trying to limit it to a five-year period due to flow meter changes and whatnot. But they didn't really pick up true wet winters, and so we tried to include those winters in the analysis. So really the peak day flow or the peak hour flow is what really changed in that analysis, and that's what caused a little bit, I think, of, in a shift in some of the what we need to pump water through the plant and to make sure that we have adequate capacity.
Now that you're saying this, I'm remembering this discussion from before.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that it's not infiltration that's causing the problem.
No, and infiltration in the winter months is definitely problematic. I know that Dylan Wade and the collection system guys are out there doing more than we've ever done in the past. We're videoing all the lines. They've just done a bunch of spot repairs in the north end of town. The I&I issue is going to be an ongoing work project forever. Mm. I don't think you'll ever – I mean, I think the goal in my mind would be to not let it get – any worse than it is now, and hopefully we can actually reduce some of that. Mm-hmm. But it's if you look at communities, I think throughout California and the nation, it's problematic for older sewer systems. Mm-hmm. And you know, they're going to do their best to try and minimize that as much as possible. And really, we're thinking if we can toe the line where we are now, it's a success. And I hope that answers your.
So just to be clear, what you're saying is we've got infiltration. We don't want it to get worse. And the repairs that we're going to do, hopefully maintain where we are, doesn't make it better.
We would, I mean, ideally you would say, yeah, we're going to cut it by 50%. Mm-hmm. Is that realistic? I don't think so at this point in time. I don't think most engineers would agree to that.
Okay.
I think if you could cut it 10%, certain communities have found, you know, maybe a huge part of their storm drain system flowing into the sewer system they didn't know about.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't found any of those surprises. Mm. And I don't think we're probably going to find any of those surprises. A lot of that is you have, what, 50 miles of pipe, and it cracks, it breaks, the ground shifts. So even if you fix stretches of pipe, mm-hmm. you're always
going
to be going back.
Break.
And, you know, really the goal is to stay on top of it, and they've been doing and treatment technology might not lend itself to composting at our current site. We are still we just basically built the last windrow that we'll be doing, and there is still compost available. We'll probably have 500 yards of compost available over about the next 4 to 5 months. So if people are still interested in picking it up, it's still going to be there.
Okay, anything else on A3?
Can I add one more comment on this? And it's not actually in my report, but I just wanted to say that the IWMA, the Integrated Waste Management Authority, has generously funded a pharmaceutical take-back program, and they are going to provide pharmaceutical take-back boxes at all of the police stations, and I think three in the county, all of the cities, and I think three or four of the sheriff's substations are going to have take-back boxes as well. It's a free service. You can basically do it anonymously, and I believe our police station will have a take-back box outside the police station. So if you have unused medications, starting September 25th is when they're going to kick off the program. It will be an ongoing process, and whatever's collected there will end up actually incinerated at a facility that's designed to get rid of pharmaceuticals in a in the best possible way, I guess. So that program will kick off at the end of this month, and I think, you know, I'd like to express my support to the IWMA, because I bugged them for a lot of years to try and do this, and it's taken a long time to get the program together, but it should be a win-win for everybody in the community.
Great, thank you. All right, I'll move we approve A3 then.
Yes, I would approve item A3.
That's a second. Okay.
Second.
All right. Betty made the motion. Carla seconding. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Cayucas.
Cayucas, motion to approve item A3.
I move we approve item A3.
Motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries.
All right. Item A4 I pulled because this is the status report on the proposal from PERC Water, and I asked Bruce just to give us an update on how that's going and where we are.
You know, I'll cover this one, and then I'll let Dennis chime in. We have been in contact with staff at PERC Water. They are scheduled to deliver a construction design report, as Mr. Owens indicated. Tentatively right now, I think that's like September 23rd, we're scheduled to sit down with them. We have been in contact with staff at Kitchell Engineering to try and develop a preliminary scope of work and level of effort and whatnot for the evaluation of that proposal. So as soon as we receive the CDR, we will finalize. We'll sit down with Kitchell and start to try and finalize that scope of work, and hopefully we'll get that ball rolling. But we're still moving forward, and like I said, you know, PERC is scheduled to deliver a CDR later this month.
Okay. Any other questions or discussion on item A4?
Yeah, actually, I wanted a follow-up question. The report is non-committal about how the PERC proposal would be presented publicly, and I'm assuming that would come and be timed with the MWH presentation as far as numbers, so we could have that comparison on the table. Do you expect that's going to be in October? It seems like that's the timing that's lining up. Where would we be there?
You know, we've kind of kicked that around informally as to when we would present that. We may bring it back at the October meeting. We may bring it back at the November meeting. A lot's going to depend on whether they just want to have a presentation or whether you actually want some analysis and review of that product. It's going to take a little while to work through those issues. We're not just going to receive it and then 2 days later have, I think, the comparison. So they may, I defer to Rob and maybe the city manager as to the exact schedule for bringing that back, but the earliest I would assume would be in at the JPA meeting in October.
And so we could have the public presentation by PERC for information only, and then get back into the issue for following up in November as far as Kitchell's reports, staff comments, and so on.
Yeah, if they were to present it, it would be purely for public presentation, I think, at that time, because I don't think we'll have we won't have time to pull a review and an analysis together on that information.
And it seems like that meeting's going to be fairly full with a presentation from MWH on their cost estimates, and it would be nice to actually receive both of those simultaneously at that meeting publicly, and then go into further community dialogue and deliberations.
I think tentatively that's what we're anticipating.
Great.
Madam Mayor, it sounds like it would be up to this board to just say that they would like it to happen that way. Could we just agendize it that way?
I think
you'd like to have the information in October, and then the evaluation comes.
The analysis by Kitchell is going to be about a 60-day process. So my concern is if your expectation is that we'll present all the information that we have, both from MWH and from PERC in October, I don't believe that will give Kitchell enough time to get an evaluation back to us by November. Okay. I believe they're 60 days.
Thank you. Oh, that answers
so,
that.
Well, then, but we could have the presentations
right.
in October. But we just won't have the
right.
evaluation until December.
Will come later.
Okay.
Okay.
But won't they start analyzing it right after the 23rd?
Well, I think that they're saying it's going to take them 60 days to complete their analysis.
Okay.
Cayucas, is that all right?
I just want to point out that we don't have a contract yet with Kitchell, so we have to refine their scope of work. That might take a week or two to throw in there to get that refined. And we want to make sure that they can do what they say they can do for the $25,000 that is budgeted. If not, that would have to come back to this board also for deliberation and authorization.
Okay. Why can't we do that now in anticipation of this report coming?
We have a preliminary scope of work from Kitchell. They've just asked if they could refine that scope of work based on the CDR.
Okay, is that process okay with Cayucas then about presenting the information in October?
Any comments from our board? That'll work.
Okay. All right, anything else on A4? Cayucas, anything else on A4?
We're not making any plans. I'm fully in support of having Kitchell analyze the technical aspects of these two different plans. But once again, we're not spending $1 on any kind of financial analysis. And I can't understand why we continually just ignore that aspect of this project, which is, of course, all anybody really cares about is what this is going to cost to the ratepayers. So how are we going to, who is going to do the financial analysis of these two plants? Are we going to have Kitchell Engineering Firm do that?
Is that part of our project manager's scope of work?
Mr. Foster, do you have a suggestion? The project manager,
you know, we didn't hire a project manager with any kind of financial background to start with. We hired him with an engineering background.
Mr. Foster, do you have an idea about a firm that could potentially work, or have you seen this done locally before? I'm sure staff could have a recommendation there as well, but I like your idea.
My proposal is that we establish a finance and risk management subcommittee similar to our technical advisory committee that can work with the staff on issues of finance and risk management and at least prioritize that a little bit into this planning process.
Let me, if I could, add a little bit. Kitchell is, I believe, is more than just a civil engineering firm. They do this cost analysis quite a bit. They're going to be giving that basic cost analysis evaluation between the two projects. That's what they've been tasked to do, is look at the two projects and compare both the construction cost and those life cycle costs.
Excuse me. What specifically is their finance background that would make them an expert in doing this analysis?
Their experience with construction management, construction type projects. They are not just a local firm. They've been doing this for a while. I believe that the suggestion of a committee could also be input into this, but at this point in time, staff has not been given any direction besides using Kitchell for the evaluation of the project, and we would be glad to entertain other avenues given that direction.
If I may ask a question,
they don't have time to explore, and this this subcommittee could work under the direction of our project manager in take in the different stakeholders in this, the green activists, reclamation people, farmers, grant writers, you know, attorneys. We need that input. We need, this is a $30 million project, and the more effort, the more time, and the more energy we put into it, the better the result will be. I don't see why we're not taking advantage of that. Or I think we could be better served by taking advantage of that.
May I ask someone, maybe Bruce or Rob Leivick, when we discussed hiring Kitchell, it's my understanding that we did not have a scope of work at that time. And there's been some talk about establishing a scope of work for this gentleman. Are we in the process of doing that? And does that scope of work include the financial analysis?
I can tell you that we have received a proposal. We provided comments on their proposal. They resubmitted a proposal. But they still have some work to do on refining their scope of work, certainly. I think... with all respect to Kitchell, you know, they were here for two meetings. They've got a very small snapshot of really what PERC Water will be providing in their CDR. And, you know, there may have been their direction may have been vague and ill-defined at the time that contract was awarded. And from what I've seen, I don't think there's a financial risk analysis in there, but I would defer to Rob or Dylan. They might have a better handle on that for...
Any additional comments from either of you?
We kind of struggle, I think, as Kitchell did, in sort of determining how to compare these two very different beasts. And how do you compare those on a kind of a co-equal or an equivalent basis? And so you go that process. Kitchell, basically, we're at the point where we've worked through our contractual issues. So they're ready to sign a contract with us. That usually takes forever. To get through the attorney. So we've gotten through that point. We've hammered through the scope. We're on our third iteration of that. That scope is likely to include a very rough financial analysis. And what that will be an analysis of initial construction costs and then some kind of life cycle analysis between those two. The difficulty is not having the CDR, and as Steve Owen mentioned earlier, the CDR is going to come with several different project delivery methods, several different ownership methods, and so that scope will need to be kind of custom tailored to the product that we receive to try to get those things in an equal basis. So that will take a couple of weeks after we receive the CDR, but it should have a financial analysis in terms of what is your net present value of these different alternatives. That's not really a risk-based analysis, but it is kind of a crude financial analysis.
It's all the more reason why we need some kind of a subcommittee, just like we have with the technical advisory committee, to work with these people on an ongoing basis so that analysis doesn't get stuck waiting some decision on us when we only meet 2 hours every month.
I would suggest that as soon as that scope of work is available, sorry, Dylan, you're hidden back there, that you forward that to our board and to your city council. I know you meet every other week. We meet at least once a month. See if we can get the timing right so that we have a chance to review that scope of work. And, Michael, if you feel that the financial portions of it are inadequate and the suggestion to form a subcommittee. I saw a number of hands back here in the back.
Okay.
And based on some of the misinformation that I heard in the public comment period, it'd be good to get some of those people on board and let them come up to speed, and I think you'll find that it'll be very helpful for everyone.
Okay.
I make a comment. My preference would be not to see another committee form, but perhaps assign some of that responsibility to the tech committee, and maybe that committee can meet a little longer than it is now. It's not on? Once again, no
more.
Is it on now?
Scope.
Not to get too much into the debate, but I think Mr. Foster's point is to take advantage of the resources in the community, the qualified citizens that have the financial backgrounds to utilize their ideas and their abilities to help us. And if we reverted to the technical subcommittee for that, we would probably be missing those opportunities because there's not really a dialogue at those meetings as far as with the public and so on.
Okay. I think that's something that I would agree that we wait until we get the outline of the job that the evaluators are going to do for us, and then decide whether we need something to supplement that or not. And our project manager may very well be able to provide some of that. So anything else on A4? Okay, I'll move approval of A4.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None.
Are we still on A?
Yeah.
Motion for approval of A4.
Move we approve A4.
Second.
Motion and a second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries.
Okay. A point of information. So am I to understand that Mr. N's suggestion is that when that scope of work comes, it will come to both boards, mm-hmm. and that was acceptable to the two bodies? Because I didn't hear us say that.
Okay.
But that's what's happening.
Have we got consensus on that over here?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Moving on. Old business. Item B1, status report on the upgrade project. And that one. Okay. This one, Mr. Delzite's going to give us.
Good evening. My name is Dennis Delzite. On the status report for the project, the first item to discuss is the fiscal impact. And one of the things that we've discovered is that as we move forward, we would like to cover any changes in professional contracts as they come along. And this particular issue came up with the MWH contract, and we're working on putting together the additional work scope, fee, and any schedule impacts so that we can keep track of it as we go along before our memories get a little hazy later on in the project. I would like to point out, too, that MWH has indicated that it's very early in the project, and it's their goal to finish the project within the contract amount without going over, if at all possible. So wanted to convey that desire on the part of MWH along with this. So wanted to cover that first. Secondly, another fiscal impact to the project involves the permit that the city and the district has with the state, and which assesses a $100 a day fine for exceeding the project schedule. The good news is that we're ahead of schedule on the design portion of the project. The permit requires that the design begin no later than September 30th of this year. And as you know, the contract has been awarded, and MWH was authorized to proceed in July. Under general activities during the past month, staff did make visits to the PERC facilities in Mountain House, which is near Tracy, and also in Santa Paula, and they received guided tours. Next, I would like to address the major milestone schedule. We are at the point now where we're just really beginning in earnest the environmental review process and the CUP and the coastal development permit process. During the next week, the public will be issued the draft EIR, and so that will involve quite a bit of activity in the coming months, and the full schedule is presented in the staff report for you. As far as the design goes, MWH has prepared and presented some preliminary site plans, architectural replans, plans, and related preliminary design documents to the technical committee at the meeting on August 19th. And later on in the agenda, MWH will be presenting that information to you. The property boundary survey has been authorized to be done. Another item of work is the hazardous materials inspection at the plant. That would involve asbestos and lead. The inspection has been done, and in fact, the report was delivered today. So we have not yet had the opportunity to evaluate it and see what impact there is. At a very quick glance, it does not look like there's any major impact. Comes up and new information occurs, it's our plan to simply update the website so that the community can always look up on the website and find out what the latest information is. A detailed graphical schedule was prepared. There have been various meetings that have occurred. Under project management, the CUP and CDP application were prepared and submitted to city staff for review. And also, I prepared the staff reports for this meeting. So that pretty much wraps up the summary of where we are, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I do. I think I have about four. I'm noticing in the first paragraph under your recommendation, the fiscal impact, we're talking about an alternative project evaluation of an MBR. And I assume this is one of the things that you said is being added to Montgomery Watson's scope of work.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
And I'm wondering, we've never talked about that. So is that just something that are you asking us now to approve that?
No. I'm informing you that that has occurred in the past. I'm not asking for any approval at this time.
I don't understand, because we didn't have that agreement with them. I thought we had agreed to do the oxidation ditch with them, and now they're saying they're going to change to an MBR.
Can I weigh in on that one? At the if my memory serves me correctly, at the June 10th JPA meeting, there was a discussion about oxidation ditch and MBR technology, and the boards requested that Mr. Hyland do a kind of a, if you want to call it, a quick and dirty comparison between. If you were to do a campus-style arrangement, which is what they're talking about constructing, and we switch that to an MBR, what the cost differentials would be. And that information was presented at the June 16th JPA meeting.
Not the cost, but the idea for them to do it was presented at the June meeting?
The idea was put out at the June 10th meeting, and they brought those numbers back at the June 16th meeting. And I think if you look at the minutes or the tape of that meeting, I think you'll see Mr. Hyland presented a cost comparison between, okay, like if you were to switch, mm-hmm, not necessarily to the PERC water style where you that, but rather if you went with campus style and you built an MBR, mm-hmm, what that cost differential would be.
Okay. So that's the June 10th meeting?
Yeah. It came at June 10th, and they delivered the information on June 16th, I believe.
Oh, so June 16th. Okay, thank you. A couple more questions. Under your discussion, you talk about the visit to the PERC facilities.
Yes.
And you mentioned this AECOM representatives. I don't know who they are. I've never heard of them before.
AECOM used to be Boyle Engineering, and those are the consultants to the district.
So did the district pay for them to go down there then? That's not coming out of your budget.
Yes, we did. We paid for it.
Okay, cool. And on the back, when you talk about the major milestones, you have down that the loan will be approved. I assume that's the state revolving loan in March of 2012. Where are the milestones for that in our outline here? All we have is a deadline, but I don't see steps along the way like you have with the EIR and other components.
Well, as additional information becomes available, we can provide that detail. Right now, we're at the very preliminary stage of administering the SRF loan. This probably gives me an opportunity to show the Council and Board that we do have a graphical schedule that has approximately 40 items that, do have beginning and ending of various work tasks. And what you have in your staff report is basically an executive summary that includes major milestones, not a lot of detail that we at the staff level have to do to make sure everything fits into place.
Great. Which one of these will be on your website?
It will be the condensed version, the executive summary that you have in your report.
And that the one that you have in your hand, the council and the board have access to?
We can make this available to you if you wish.
Okay, great. And then, and you just said that the hazardous material inspection was done, and will we get a copy of that in our to-read file?
If you wish. We only received one copy. In fact, we were just before the meeting talking about getting additional copies. So,
would it be part of the EIR, perhaps? There is a hazmat section in there.
I think that would take some expertise that I don't have to know whether that would be in there. I know that if it's a significant...
Coming regularly so
yes.
We can see what's going on?
Definitely, on a monthly basis, yes.
Okay. When will that be then?
By around the 15th of each month, okay. You should receive the billings. If you're interested in approximately where we are now, approximately $13,000 to $14,000 is the combined total of myself and sub-consultants.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Delzite, for the report. And my only request is, as we're looking at these invoices and how much has been billed to us, I'd really appreciate itemization so we can actually see what was charged for what service and have it broken down just a little more. At this point, those details would be helpful as we're going forward, especially as you bring back MWH's alternative design of that amendment. We definitely would like to see where money has been spent and so forth.
Okay, will do.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anything else? Yep. Okay, Cayucas.
These, we know these amounts that are listed as the contract amount.
Yes.
Those are not fixed amounts, right? In other words, we don't have a contract with Montgomery Watson Harza that says they will do all the work on this project and under no circumstances will it exceed $2.7 million.
Well, yes, that's the not to exceed, and the actual amount of time and effort that they put into the work is what they will bill. They could possibly come under that $2.7 million amount.
But they can't exceed that.
They cannot exceed that without an amendment to the contract.
Okay. And is that the same for the environmental contract amount?
Yes. It's my understanding, however, that the JPA board has given staff authority to approve contracts in the amount not to exceed $50,000. And the purpose for that is so that to keep the project moving. So if something came up that was unexpected and unknown at the time the contract was signed, so the work wouldn't have to stop and wait for a staff report and a board meeting. Nevertheless, the documentation must be provided so to the contract so that it provides clear communication between the JPA and the consultant as to what the actual contract amount is, if there are any changes in the contract amount.
Okay, so on the environmental report, the contract amount is $333,431 and $286,237 has been paid. Amount remaining $47,194. Does that mean then that the maximum amount more we will pay to get the EIR is $47,194?
That is correct. Unless there's an amendment to the contract, that is exactly what this information is.
You anticipate any amendments to the contract?
I'm not aware of any amendments at this time.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a couple questions. go back to your first paragraph, Dennis, where we talk about unanticipated new work tasks. And I recall directing staff or MWH to do some extra work. I'm curious whether or not we change our contract to show an amount for that extra work, or is that to be included in the $2.7 million? How is this contract managed? Who signs change orders? When we as the board and city council here ask MWH to look into something like alternative project evaluation for MBR, when do we find out how much that's going to cost us to as we try to make that decision?
Well, I think that's a real good question. Now that I'm on board, I'll tell you what my style is if I were here at a meeting tonight and one of your members asked for extra work that was not a part of the original contract, what I would attempt to do is to make sure there's a consensus among your board so that I would be sure that that's what the majority wants, first of all. And if that's the case, then we would proceed with the work and immediately get in touch with the consultant and negotiate for the extra fee that would be involved in doing the work. Be sure that we clearly understand what the extra work scope is, and if there are any impacts to the schedule, don't have the contract in front of you and you're not reading it. I, as the project manager, and MWH, as the consultant, have the responsibility for knowing what's in the contract and what isn't. So, again, if we hypothesize that you wanted extra work tonight, I would probably run over to Steve and say, Steve, I don't think this is in the contract, is it? And he would say no, and I'd say, well, okay, I want to be sure that I have a majority of the board that would like some extra work done, and if that's the case, then I'll work with Steve on it and bring it back to you at the next meeting as a status report or come back to you and get your permission to proceed if it's over $50,000. But I understand clearly what you're saying is it's important to have clear communication on things that cost extra money. And so that's what my intention is to be make sure that there is a clear understanding between your board and consultants and myself on anything that costs extra money.
Okay, suppose we make a decision to ask MWH to look into something, or RRM, is that right? to look into changing the design that we don't like this, or we want them to do this extra stuff. And then we make another decision the same evening. Is it $50,000 per evening or per meeting? Or is it $50,000 per item? And we could rack up a couple hundred thousand here in an evening real easy.
Per item. Per work
okay,
task.
But then we could, in an evening, rack up about $200,000 worth of, oh, we'd like you to do this, this, and this.
Well, if it's close to 50, we'll let you know right away and say we're not sure. We haven't calculated it out or negotiated it yet, but it looks like a significant one. So we'll have to come back to you at the next meeting with to get your permission to enter into a contract amendment.
Well, my concern is it's already occurred here, and we'll discuss this maybe in our next few agenda items, is how this occurs and how easy it is to get into this trap of changing things and then get a bill later. So,
well, I think that's a very good point, and I want to be sure that this is communicated every meeting to you.
Okay, another question on the $51,800. Is at this time, is that a liability that we have? It's in your next paragraph.
No, we do not have to write a check. It's a tally that goes up and down during the course of the project, and the very last item on your schedule is the March 31st, 2014 date, which is when, under the permit, the city and district are required to be in full compliance. If we meet that date, we don't owe anything.
But right we now, could, if we miss it by one day, then we've accumulated all these. And this, we're already at 51,800. So if this goes on for another 4 years, we could be at a quite a large sum, I'm assuming. And if we're a day past March 31st, 2014, we get to pay all these fines. How do we get them to go away as we go along to limit our liability?
Can I just, you know, my understanding, and Mr. Schultz or Mr. Carmel, could, the legal counsel can correct me if, but my understanding is that you're going to, the and I can verify with regional board staff that when we public notice the draft EIR, that we have met that milestone, and that you're not continuing to accrue a fine of $100 a day for the next 4 years. So you would still have the $51,800 hanging over your head if you didn't get to the end date. But I will confirm tomorrow or early next week with Regional Board that once we, if we're late on a milestone, but once we accomplish that milestone, that we're not continuing to accrue fines as we move forward.
Okay, I just was, and I had a discussion with Bill about this. Your choice of words here where it says fines accrued on intermediate milestones would be waived. I said, well, the terminology there, would be waived, could be waived, or would be waived, or will be waived. And if it said will be waived, I'd be a lot more comfortable. So I think checking with regional would be a real good idea.
I can assure you on that if you meet the end date milestone, you will not be penalized for any interim milestone penalties. When they stop adding the tally up, I will verify that for you.
Okay. It just seems only fair that if we're meeting milestones along the way, that they're not charging us for them or holding us liable for some fee that they decide to do later on.
The food to microorganism ratio and all these delicate balances together. But 2 months, in my opinion, seems like there is enough time. The more the better. I agree with you on that.
My point is that's if the plant gets completed on January 31st.
Yes.
I'm saying that plant should be completed 4, 5, 6 months before that date to make sure. I think we should push to get this thing done sooner. At not too long ago, we were a year ahead of schedule. And now somehow we're accumulating some possible fines. We're behind schedule on some items. And I think we need to try to correct that. And I'm looking at you.
We have a 22-month time frame built in for construction between the start of construction and completion. As MWH gets further along in their design process, they're going to advise us on what they think would be a reasonable time for completion to put in the contract. If you put too much time, then, of course, the contractor comes out and doesn't work efficiently, and sometimes projects just don't go too well. If you don't give them enough time, then you pay a premium for having the project fast track. So we'll be looking to MWH to tell us what the ideal time frame would be so that we're right where we ought to be when it comes to specifying the time for completion. And I agree with you, the sooner we can finish ahead of schedule, the better we would like it.
All right, on the next item where you have design. Here we have a contract amount with MWH you specified, and I'm again looking back to the first page saying, well, we asked them to do some extra work, but the contract amount is the original contract amount. So have we changed their contract or added anything?
No, that is what I mentioned on the first page that I want to bring back at the next meeting.
Okay.
And this gives me an opportunity again to emphasize what MWH has said is it's so early in the project. They've only billed $215,000 out of the $2.7 million. They're still hoping that they can complete the work, all of it, even with the extras within that $2.7 million. But I think for the sake of clear communication and not getting to the point where later on in the project we're trying to remember what happened way back in September of 2010. We need to keep the paperwork up to date and make sure that we're accurate in tallying the work, that the extra work that we asked them to do. There might even be some work that might be eliminated as we go along through the project, but that usually doesn't happen.
Okay. I appreciate the approach we're taking. But my concern is that you have some extra work here that we've requested.
Yes.
MWH should, in my opinion, just request that amount of money be not at this time included in the $2.7 million. It can be a separate line item that says, well, we'll try to get it done for the $2.7, but you've asked me to do this other work. Here's the amount of the other work, so that we know as we go exactly what we've asked that's not within the scope of work. So what I'd really like, and I'd ask for the council's support and the board here, is that we define the process of how change orders are going to be done, who's going to sign them, who approves them, what's our part in that process. Is it a member of the board, or does it take the full board to approve a change order? Again, that issue of the $50,000 per item could be several items in an evening, and so maybe we need to have a little better definition of what we're trying to do here. And I think, Carla, weren't you quite adamant about that $50,000 and how that works? And
yeah, I didn't even want $50,000. I was wanting it to come back at a smaller amount. But I agree. I think what you're asking is just a separate line item section so we can keep track as we go through the process. Shouldn't be that difficult.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's a liability when we ask them to do something extra, and we ought to know how much we've stuck our neck out for. If it all works out under the 2.7, they'll be heroes, and we'll think they're great. And if it doesn't, we'll know that we owe them that difference.
Yes.
Okay.
But the work on the flows and loads and on this MBR analysis, you know, that was done in April, May, June, as I recall. I mean, why do we not know that now? You know, it seems to me that you're not going to get a really, I don't know, that seems to be way too compressed a time period to ask a general contractor who's got to get major bids from subcontractors to pull all that information together.
Well, that's a comment we'll look into and consider as we refine the schedule.
Okay.
Thank you.
I have one final comment.
Yes.
On the items of billing, where, for example, on the MWH, you've shown that they've billed $215,071.
Yes.
And you've billed zero.
Yes.
Must be that retirement check, right? Thank you. What I'd suggest is that there be another item added to that tells us percent complete, so we can see how much money's been spent, but I think that Steve would tell us that they're well past percentage complete in terms of percentage of the $2.7 million. So it'd be nice to know we've spent 10% of the money and we're 10% done.
Sure, we can easily do that.
Okay.
Would you like that for each of the consultants listed?
Well, I think that would be helpful.
Okay.
So we know that we're not paying for work that we haven't received.
Sure.
To put it mildly.
Will that be an extra expense?
for Dennis.
I don't bill very often.
Dennis, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Anything else on this item? All right. We're just receiving the report, and we've provided direction. Would you like to take a short break?
Oh, yes.
Okay. We'll take a short break and come back.
And we're good to go. All right, we're back. And we'll start with our new business. Item C1 is the report from the TAC members on the August 19th meeting. And on our side, we got Mr. Grantham's going to make that report.
Hi, thank you. We met on August 19th, and following public comment and approval of the minutes, Bruce Keogh gave a report on the conceptual site plan as discussed at the April JPA meeting. Steve Hyland of MWH showed us some alternative site plans and asked for input and preferences. I think Mr. Hyland said that the topographical map would be ready either this month or next month. We had a review and discussion of architectural treatment. We talked about the various options such as water feature, durability in the marine environment, color, landscaping, cost per square feet, and perimeter fencing. Mr. Carmel from Cayucas gave us a presentation on the governance sections, talking about voting and the requirements regarding that, and also gave us a review of the draft finance agreement between City of Morro Bay and Cayucas to facilitate the acquisition of the state revolving fund. And Mr. Carmel said he would bring back a flow chart regarding more sections of the government agreement. And that's about it.
Okay. Cayucas, have anything to add?
First of all, that was primarily the comments from the minutes. But the next items on the agenda here will cover the things that we discussed at the TAC meeting, and I'll expect the TAC members to be able to help with the discussion and perhaps highlight some of the comments that were made at the TAC meeting as Pat and Steve go through their presentation. I had just one simple question and I'd like to ask Tim Carmel, I guess. I don't see Rob Schultz. In our minutes here, Tim, it says that we approved the minutes of the previous TAC meeting. Is there a procedure in the TAC meetings about how we're to vote? We understand how we vote here in the JPA. What's the correct way to do business at the TAC meeting?
At this point, is this on? At this point, we don't have formalized procedural rules for the TAC, the committee itself. So we've been.
Is there any reason why we have to approve the minutes for the TAC meeting?
No. No, the minutes are really just to guide whoever wasn't there and to refresh the recollections of those that were as to what was done.
Right.
There's no legal requirement to have minutes at all.
So we have no need to take a vote. All we can do is if we want to correct them or if we find something in them that needs to be corrected, we can do that just by a statement.
Informally.
Right. So we don't have to. We don't have to because we don't vote. We don't make decisions in that committee.
No, it's a very fluid document, and there's no legal requirement for it.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'd agree that we should keep minutes so that other people can read what we discussed, what decisions, or how we felt about it. But I don't see us as a decision-making body, and I think we should refrain from making motions and pretending to approve things when we're not in that capacity.
Right, and I think the point there is just that most of these items are being vetted on a sort of a base foundational level through the TAC. They come back here for action. The TAC's there to sort of flesh out some of the issues, discuss what each member of the committee feels are important with regard to each of those issues, and then to come here to actually address, formally approving them.
Let me ask you one more question. There was a comment made earlier about not, discussing these items with the public that may appear at those meetings. I know we have a procedure here. Or sometimes we take public comment at the time we discuss the items. In this case, I believe Noah mentioned it, and Noah very respectfully did not comment because they already have two other council members in the room, and I realize that, and Noah understands that he can't do that, but can we have discussions with other members of the public in a sort of roundtable discussion type?
Absolutely. You know, again, the procedure is wide open as to how, on any specific TAC agenda, you want to approach it. We can solicit full public comment. You know, there is a public comment required under the Brown Act on everything. It can be done at one single time. It can be done item by item. So I think the interaction with the public, my opinion, is interaction with the public on these issues is really important. But again, the manner in which you choose to do that is very fluid, and it's up to the presiding officer at those meetings or the advisory committee as a whole.
Okay. My concern is here in public comment period, technically we're not allowed to respond. Is that correct?
Technically, under the Brown Act, you mean you're talking about public comment now?
Yes.
Yeah. You're very, very confined as to how you can respond to public comment under the Brown Act. Typically, attorneys, and I know Rob and I are of this ilk, we let it go quite a bit because it's hard to stop, for one thing, and because it's quite productive in many areas. You're not making decisions during that time, and it's a pretty unusual arrangement to have two separate agencies that meet essentially once a month. So we try to make the most of it. But, you know, the Brown Act actually says you can provide direction to staff, ask staff to bring something back. Under the Act, you're really not supposed to flesh out whatever the comment is, unless it's on the agenda separately. And then, of course, when the item does come up, you're free to talk about it at length with the public, without the public.
Okay. My concern here at these meetings is that there are a number of things that were said in the public comment period that indicate that the speaker is not up to speed, hasn't been to the meetings, doesn't know the decisions we've made, and yet we're not allowed to say, hey, by the way. And, you know, obviously the other side of that is we don't want to get in a one-on-one discussion with someone, but a mechanism to allow people to become informed and to correct some of these misinformation things that appear at the public comment period.
It's a difficult situation. Every agency handles it differently. I do think that the underpinning of the Brown Act is public comment. So, certainly a certain amount of public comment on everything is good. How you choose to respond to it, I mean, I typically, you know, I interrupt and say, wait a minute, we're way out of any agenda item here. I think we've become less aggressive at stopping that. But if it's the direction to kind of bring it back to the focus, I'm very conservative in terms of my approach to the Brown Act. So I don't think there should be a lot of response to public comment unless it's to say you need to read the minutes from the last 2 years to find out that we've been dealing with that issue for a long time. I feel the same sort of frustration that you do when I hear some of the comments. But, again, that's the underpinning of the Brown Act, so we have to allow.
Okay, well, I don't mind that people can come up and say what they want. It's difficult to sit here sometimes and know that they're misinformed and want to correct or let them know the rest of the story, and we're not allowed to do that. So I just hope the public appreciates that our hands are tied when we're up here, and sometimes you kind of call us idiots for not...
How to turn those mics on? Because it was very difficult. And I apologize for not speaking up at the time, but I felt I didn't have the right to do that.
Well, as a member of the public, yeah, you were in there in that capacity.
Okay.
You do. And now that you've noted it, we'll make sure that the public has good acoustics and the opportunity to respond.
Great. Thanks.
I'd like to make a comment and ask a question. You know, do we have a written scope of what the responsibilities are of the TAC?
I don't believe we do. We don't
I
have
mean,
a...
I mean, my understanding was it was to discuss technical aspects of the sewer construction. Now we find out that the legal framework of the joint tenancy, the ownership, the financing, all of that is running through the technical advisory board. And even though it's not, I understand it's not a decision-making committee, it still sets the tone and sets the direction by deciding what gets put on the table for discussion. And I would like to find out what the scope of those responsibilities are of the committee.
Because
it's the only one we have, and they're dealing with everything.
I'll weigh in on that because I've been kind of surprised at some of the things that have been brought forward at the TAC. The initial reason for the TAC being formed was to go through the agreement.
to redo the joint agreement. That was our purpose. So it's been interesting. We've been getting other stuff in there, and I'm not sure why, quite honestly, but that was our initial task, was to go through that agreement and suggest the rewording for it so that we could get that agreement solidified to go forward.
Madam Mayor, when was that? When you were appointed to the TAC? Mm-hmm. Okay, I was on the TAC before that,
right.
And so I think if we went back
technical.
To the when the original motion was made, we could find out what Mr. Foster's
right.
looking for, because
right.
I think this is a new item.
Right.
And if it's the desire of the joint bodies to bring that matter back for formal consideration, so you can identify specific tasks.
I think that might be a good idea. At this point.
We should do it, and maybe we'll do the next meeting.
Yeah, I think we should. Okay. We'll agendize that for our next tech meeting. Okay. Moving on to new business. Second item. Discussion and confirmation of the role of wastewater project manager. Recommend to receive and provide direction to the staff. And I think we have some staff report on this. Andrea, is this one that you had a report for us, or Bruce?
I was going to lead it off. The subject of the staff report is the discussion and confirmation of the role of the wastewater treatment plant project manager. A little background, the award of contract for project management services was conducted or awarded at the July 15th JPA meeting. There was Mr. Schultz, a legal counsel for the city, placed the issue on the August 9th council agenda because of a potential issue as to whether there was a proper quorum at the meeting to conduct city business. Really, the item at the August 9th meeting was to reaffirm the award of contract. It's at that meeting there was discussion of this item, and there were comments from council members that Mr. Delzite should participate as a project manager, but not participate in any ongoing analysis of the proposal by PERC Water. Subsequent discussions between city and district staff led to some confusion as to what the role of Mr. Delzite could or could not be in relation to the proposal that we will receive by PERC Water. We're looking tonight for the council and the board to consider allowing Mr. Delzite to participate in the preparation of the scope and review of the MWH and PERC analysis by Kitchell, and any and there may be other duties as assigned as we get into that analysis, because it's probably going to be a broad scope of services. But we're you know, from a staff standpoint, at least my city staff standpoint, we hired a project manager to assist us in any number of capacities in the upgrade project. The PERC proposal is going to be a complex analysis that's going to have to be conducted, and we would like to see Mr. Delzite use his experience in past projects and in wastewater treatment experience to assist us in the development of that scope of work. I think it will expedite that scope, and it will add more value to the analysis that we're looking to get. In addition, you know, just the scope of potential project management services that was identified in the original RFP summarized, advise, and represent the city and district in the replacement of their treatment plant, provide project management, coordinate project activities and consultants, assist in and coordinate activities associated with the design process, and assist in hiring.
Manager, City of Morro Bay. I'm here just to really emphasize staff's recommendation, and I provide an example tonight. And I had a citizen come to my office on Friday afternoon, and she brought this paper into me, and she was attended one of several, I think, events in the City of Morro Bay. I can't speak for Cayucas, about information that's out in the public about the project. And I think when we look at this information, certainly there is some information missing. It's like, where's it's the rest of the story? Some of it is semantics. But my concern is that this type of information is in the public, and it may be widely in the public, and I think that it's citizens aren't informed. They don't have the information. And I think Mr. Delzite can certainly help us be the point person to the public, and be one consistent disseminator of information. Certainly staff does that, but they are swamped with other things. So I think that this is a good example, and that's why I wanted to bring it forward tonight, that this would, this extension, I guess, of his contract would probably be very beneficial.
Okay. Any questions for staff on this issue, or do you want to make your comments?
I have a comment, and I have two questions. Is Mr. Schultz has left the room, and he's not coming back?
Right.
Okay. And this is just a clarification. This is an additional task in addition to the task that Mr. Keogh's talking about, because he was talking about evaluation of PERC, and this is PR. And so is that how you meant that?
I think they're really tied in together. I think it's really all about the project. It's all about getting the right information out. So I think some of what he's already doing is a little bit of PR, but I think they're definitely tied together. If you want to separate them, we can, but I think it's all really tied together. All of our pushes is to make sure that the public has the accurate information about these projects. And because we're on the dual track, because we're looking at the PERC project and we're looking certainly moving down the path with MWH, I think it's extremely important that misinformation, incomplete information, isn't going out to the public and touted as fact.
Okay. I'm not sure how that relates to evaluation, to doing a scope of helping write a scope of work for Kitchell, though.
Then you can call it two different tasks.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Rick, you had a comment?
Just that, you know, we hired Mr. Delzite to be our point man in this, and I think to not have him involved in these endeavors is not certainly the thing to do. I have a lot of faith in him. He's done this before. I think he can only help us expedite the process, and so I'm all for it.
Okay. Carla, comment?
I would agree with Mr. Grantham in that respect, that I think that the more information that Mr. Delzite can be a part of and work towards putting out the correct information to the community will provide more transparency. And I certainly support adding that scope to him.
Betty?
I agree. I think the public relations is a component of his scope of work, but I'm not sure that I heard them respond to the idea of where he should be involved with in regard to the Kitchell evaluation. And for me, that's not a long-term thing. My idea of this parallel track was we have the MWH, we have the PERC, and at some point they're together until they're both presented to this body. At that point, we make a decision, and then one of them goes away. And so I don't see that as a long-term thing, and that decision actually belongs to this body, and that it's not part of what he may or may not think about that. It's what this board thinks about that, and that our information is coming from Kitchell, not from our staff.
I actually agree with Ms. Winholt's comments. I find a $25,000 not to exceed contract with Kitchell as quite substantial, and at this point we have no idea of the costs of what this extension of Mr. Delzite's contract would be. Very uncomfortable with not knowing those costs. Furthermore, I also acknowledge that Mr. Delzite has extensive background in wastewater treatment, but I realize, too, that he was on the selection board that vetted our request for proposals and ended up selecting MWH. So personally, I think it would be better for us to separate that out to make sure that we don't further feed the concerns from the public that we have a process that's biased, and leave it up to our third-party reviewer, Kitchell, and our own board. If we do appoint a citizens advisory body to help us with that, that's fantastic, and I feel like that's plenty of information for us to disseminate, and an additional voice would probably confuse things more than anything else.
All right, well, I'm going to go to page 2 of the paragraph.
Thinking it would not exceed $5,000, I would have to say, too, that none of us have received the PERC report yet. The Kitchell proposal also has not been finalized, so there's some unknowns, but it's hard for me to see going beyond that. An example of what I could have been helping staff with prior to this time could have been negotiating, working with Kitchell to refine the work scope and fee and schedule, and taking the place of city staff and having to do this and get the contract ready and get it in front of your body.
Okay, thank you. Cayucas?
Comments?
I have a lot of faith and respect in your ability and integrity. And I don't have any problem with you assisting in coordinating the flow of information. But I believe that this analysis needs to be objective. And I've already suggested at the break that in the contract with Kitchell, we have specifically a clause that says they will do this analysis, and they agree that they will have no other involvement in any other aspect of this project. It's very important that we maintain the objectivity. And given that the decision of whether we choose Plan A or Plan B could, in fact, affect your $250,000 contract, I think you have a conflict of interest. And so I think we do need to limit your involvement in the decision-making process of this analysis. And I don't mean that to be insulting, but it obviously, as I read it, it is a conflict. And I guess I am troubled by this, that you could expedite the Kitchell analysis by assisting in the development of the scope of work. I really don't know what that means, but, you know, in a lot of these things, defining the scope of work is sort of answering the question. And so I think that's more involvement than simply just acting as our representative to provide them with the information that they need to make a timely decision.
Well, I agree that with the staff that I think that it would be very helpful to have Mr. Diesel assist in the development of the scope. I understand, to me it makes sense, because I think everyone that has expertise in this area should be involved in the discussion and looking at the both situations. So I would support that.
I would also support it and support the staff's conclusions and recommendation.
Tim Carmel, can you help us with this comment about a conflict that Mr. Delzite might or might not have?
You know, the term conflict of interest has a lot of different meanings. In the strict legal sense, there's no conflict, there's no economic interest at stake, at least from my perspective. I sort of grappling with the issue. So, legally, I don't know that I can really answer that question. He doesn't have an inherent conflict. He's a consultant who's being asked to analyze a spectrum of possibilities, a scope. In one situation, he can analyze a scope. In another situation, this happens a lot in government, where different elements pop up on the radar screen that you didn't anticipate, and you have to deal with them without necessarily reinventing the wheel. So I don't look at this as a big issue. It's a lot bigger now that I hear some of the discussion. And I don't mean to infer that you don't have a basis to say there is some tension between the two proposals and looking at both of them. Maybe with his history, he has some bias going in. I happen to know Dennis for a long time, and I just think he can be objective in dealing with the issue. But it's not a legal conflict, if that's what you're asking me.
It is. Thank you. I support staff's recommendation. Frankly, I think it's a stretch to accuse Mr. Delzide of not being objective here. I really can't understand why we wouldn't want our project manager.
Part of my responsibility under my contract is to answer questions from the public on this project. And so theoretically, if I'm not involved, if a question comes up regarding the PERC proposal, I'd have to say, sorry, I'll have to refer that to someone else. But thank you for the opportunity.
Go ahead. Okay.
Noah. Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that we've heard from previous PERC proposals and from looking at the history in Santa Paula that there's actually the potential in the design, build, operate model that a project manager position becomes folded into that contract. And I think that's inherent in that decision and something that we need to be careful about. Mr. Delzide, you have to respect his interest in wanting to be involved there because of his passion for the industry and the project. But at the same time, I think we're setting ourselves up and him up to be a subject of a backlash from the public. We're already becoming coming under scrutiny from the public regarding conflicts of interest and bias on behalf of different members of the staff. And whether that's true or not, we need to be cautious about feeding that. And in this case, if we limit Mr. Delzide's involvement to the basic development of the scope of work, helping to stream like that, and making sure we're avoiding those issues, then I think we're being cautious there. But if we go any further than that, we're asking for even more public scrutiny and concern and distrust. And already this project's teetering on the edge of a major backlash from the public, and we need to do everything we can to avoid that. So I think Mr. Delzide obviously has some extra expertise there, but that's what we're paying Kitchell for, is to be a non-involved third party that can come in objectively. So I would hope we would limit it to the minimum of just developing the scope and working, helping to support our staff to do that and turn it over to Kitchell for any analysis.
Well, I agree with you as far as the extent of his involvement. I think it should be limited to helping establish the scope of work. I don't think he should be making a recommendation. That does have to be us, and Kitchell is the one who's supposed to be recommending us the information to make that decision. So I agree with that, but I would certainly want him involved in helping to establish that scope of work and being aware and being the information point for what's happening all along the way so that, you know, he can give correct information out to the public, because that is what we need, so that we don't have people calling up City Hall and who knows who's going to talk to him that day, who's available and what information they have or don't have. We need to have somebody who is the focal point of all the information and being able to give it back out. So I think that there's two separate things there, but I'm not saying that he should be involved in the decision-making process between the two projects, in my opinion. So how do the rest of you feel on that?
I sat in on both interviews that we the staff held to select a project manager, and both companies were asked a question in terms of which they both responded the PERC issue, implying a bias, and whether that was fed to them because of the questions they were being asked or if that was their true response. It makes me feel uncomfortable, and maybe that was in the moment of the interview, and maybe that's not a personal opinion that would continue on through this process. But I very much support what Mr. Smuckler has said, that we can't afford to even appear as though there's a conflict here with the public and with the process of what's going on, because I've raised questions about the process. And so I think I have to say, Mr. Renz, I did not hear Mr. Foster at all impinge Mr. Deltside's integrity. He very much said no, but what he's trying to do is protect Mr. Deltside and the board and us from not even appearing to have a bias there to protect us in case something it gets blown out of proportion. So I would be not in favor of, very much, of course, in terms of the PR, but very much in favor of him not participating in any way with the analysis of Montgomery Watson and Perk with Kitchell.
Okay, let's separate then what we're defining as the analysis. What I'm talking about is helping to establish the scope of work of the comparison, which is what staff is otherwise going to be tasked with having to do, and that's where we're running into time constraints.
Well, I think Mr. Foster pointed out that when you define the scope of work, that in itself...
City and district staff are recommending that the role of the project manager include assistance with the analysis of the PERC CDR.
Bruce,
they believe that Mr. Dotson will help to expedite the dual track and so forth. I don't see that there's a problem here.
Bruce or Rob, can you tell us what?
You know, just in terms of the scope of work, the scope that was submitted by Kitchell, in my opinion at this point, was woefully insufficient. And I think that was based on attendance at two meetings. I think it was based on a lack of understanding as to what PERC would actually bring forward. And I think, you know, this is a huge milestone in this project. And, you know, we hired a project manager to assist us in the coordination of numerous activities. And what we're really looking for is to make sure that when we define the scope of work, I don't think, you know, and when we normally hire a consultant, the consultant brings us a scope of work because we ask for it. We refine that scope. We don't just take whatever they hand us the majority of the time and just run with it, because it may not have the level of effort in all areas that you'd like to see. And I think from what I've seen of the Kitchell proposal so far, it's going to take, if city staff does it, it's going to take Rob Leivick, Dylan Wade, and myself numerous hours to hammer that scope out with Kitchell. And we're going to have to see the CDR before we can do that, because we don't know entirely what's in that CDR. And we want to make sure that when that analysis is conducted, that they do as thorough a job as possible and that they answer the questions that need to be answered. And hopefully that helps.
Just curious to know, because it seems like this review that Kitchell's going to perform is really going to be tagged to both firms and have major implications for them, not only on this project, but going forward. So one thought could be to make sure that the scope is fair and that there's consistency. We could ask that Mr. Delzite supports in developing the scope, working with Kitchell, but that we get actually approval from both PERC and MWH to that scope. And they both agree, okay, this is going to be resolving the questions that I would want to see resolved if someone is evaluating my system, my design. And perhaps that could be a way that we could confirm that this
is going to
be
focused
there in fairness.
For Cayucas, I'd like to introduce a motion.
We had public comment at the beginning of the meeting.
The motion.
Yes, we did.
How do we know what you're talking about? We had public comment at the beginning of the meeting.
I'm sorry, sir. You're out of order. I'm sorry, sir. You're out of order. At the beginning of the meeting, I told people that we would take public comment on anything on the agenda, and that was what we did. It's what we always do. I'm sorry. You're out of order. Okay, Bruce. Okay, did you want
to... For Cayucas, I'd like to introduce a motion, please. The motion would be that the role of the project manager include assistance with the analysis of the PRC CDR.
Is there a second? Motion and a second. By way of discussion, I would only comment that we will see the scope, I believe, come back to a JPA meeting. Is that right, Bruce?
Can you repeat that motion, please?
It's out of the conclusion from the staff report.
That the role of the project manager include assistance with the analysis of the PERC CDR.
What about public relations?
That was my motion.
Let me ask again then. The scope of work then we expect to see back at the council and our board. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. Thank you. Any other discussion? Cayucas, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Here's the motion.
Do we have a motion over here yet, or are we still discussing?
Here's the motion.
Make one.
It's got to be the same motion.
Well, I was going to put something on there about the public feedback.
Can you make two motions then, and then we'll vote on the second one?
Okay.
Thank you.
I'd like to have Dennis Delzite participating in the scope of work and review of MWH PERC analysis by Kitchell.
Second.
All right, discussion. All right, there was Noah's point about bringing that back for approval. Is that
that's,
one of your...
That's part of my current contract.
It is, okay. So we don't really need a motion on that then?
Well, only to clarify that that also involves PERC,
yes.
The PERC situation.
Okay.
So that provides clarity, I think, to me and the staff that that's my role.
Okay. All right. So there is help to that motion then. All right. Any further discussion on that motion?
Yeah. Mr. Delzite, you quoted an estimate of about $5,000. Does that include, with this amendment to the contract, does that include both of these additions, or are you thinking that will be different? I'd like to know the price.
That should cover it, both.
All right, any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, all in favor. Thank you. Cayucas.
Let me go ahead. Same motion, please.
Same motion.
Second.
Motion and a second. By way of discussion, Dennis, sorry to abuse you at the microphone here, but
okay.
Your contract is a not to exceed. Is that how that works?
Yes, that's correct.
So aren't we similar to the situation here that we had with MWH, that perhaps the $5,000 is included in the not to exceed?
That's correct. This is a task that was not known and at the time we entered into the contract. It's something new, so it's a new work task. So I think to provide clear communication between myself and your body that it would be appropriate to for me to submit a written estimate and work scope to you for this extra work task.
Then I would ask for a motion of reconsideration for financial reasons. I would like to vote no.
On the second motion.
Well, it sounds like both items are going to be over the $250,000 that we approved.
No, you said that the $5,000 would be above, would cover both. That's what you told Noah.
But then just now, Mr. Ames asked him if that wouldn't be above the $250,000.
It could be. It might be.
And so, therefore, we would be spending more money.
Right.
And I don't want to spend more
money.
Well,
you already voted no on the part that would spend more money.
It wouldn't be included in the other?
Yeah.
Okay. But I'm fine.
Okay.
I'd just like to clarify something. I think we have a definitional problem on a not-to-exceed contract.
Good.
You know, you don't have a contract not-to-exceed. You have a contract that says once you get to $250,000, then you have to come back before the board to get additional funds. But the typical definition of a not-to-exceed contract is you do a scope of work for time and materials, and if you need more time, it's limited to an aggregate amount of money. And that is not my understanding of what your contract is. And that was specifically why I asked about the other contracts in this engineering thing. And that's really an important distinction.
I actually was debating whether to get up or talk about that. The contracts are written as time and materials not to exceed. And so you go, that contract can't be exceeded, but there's a defined scope that goes with that dollar amount. And so you go, in fairness to so your contractor, your consultants, you've defined the amount of work that they're going to do by defining the scope. You've set a timeline to it with your schedule, and then they give you a dollar amount based off of that scope of work and that schedule. In Dennis's scope of work, he didn't anticipate, because the board had basically said, we're not going to hear a presentation from PERC at that point in time. And so he didn't anticipate engaging in that process or participating in that process. So that was not in his scope of work. So that's been added to his scope, and he's estimated that that will be about a $5,000 impact. However, his contract, until we've amended it, will be not to exceed $250,000. He's basically flagging the item and saying, this is something that's outside of my scope. And this is very common with professional service contracts. You flag it, you say it's outside of the scope of work that we anticipated doing. You don't know if he's going to use all $250,000 of his previous scope. So you go, like in the discussion earlier about MWH, some things come in of scope, some things come out of scope. Your scope generally bounces around as you move through the contract. It's only changed by amendment. And so you go, I think it's an important sort of clarification to make. His contract is for $250,000. But we've added a task tonight that he did not anticipate an additional amount for that. But it's a fairly common contract mechanism, time and materials not to exceed. And correct, it's both an hourly contract and then also a not to exceed contract. It's kind of a hybrid approach. I hope that clarifies things. And I would happily take any questions about kind of how those contracts are written. Or Tim could also tag in if you need his expertise. Thank you.
All right. Ready to move on? Okay. We're on item 3, which is consideration and discussion of the conceptual site plan for the upgrade project. And that is going to be Mr. Delphi.
Conceptual site plans have been prepared, and in fact, there's an alternative plan that has been prepared by MWH for consideration by your body. This plan and the original plan were presented to the JPA Technical Committee on August 19th, and MWH is prepared to provide an overview summary with some PowerPoint slides to go over the two options. And what we hope to get from tonight's discussion on this is some comments and direction from your body so that we may proceed with the site plan, further site plan considerations and design on the project. So what I'd like to do is turn this over to Steve Hyland of MWH to go ahead and proceed with his PowerPoint.
Yeah, point of clarification.
Quick question here. Yeah,
go ahead.
My question relates to the draft EIR, which I see as an essential piece to the information about our site and the elements that we're dealing with in that site. So besides informational as a presentation as far as these preliminary concepts, it seems like we're premature at this point to start to make any sort of serious decisions about layout and especially design until the draft EIR has been released and we actually have that information to digest as a board and the public. So I guess my question is how are we not getting ahead of ourselves with this discussion?
Well, I agree. We would not proceed with design work, and also whichever alternative that that your body chooses would become a part of the draft EIR that goes out to the public. Thank you for that clarification.
Was that an answer? I didn't get that as an answer.
My interpretation of that was that depending on what we select tonight, that is going to focus the EIR on the specifics with what we're trying to establish through one proposal. It doesn't talk about the overall site conditions, but it gives the EIR some ability to say, well, this is what we anticipate trying to do, so the EIR is going to interact with that. That was my interpretation of what you said.
That's accurate.
But should the EIR do that?
Do you have a question?
Mr. Carmel, do you have a comment? Or Mr. Leibich, do you have a comment on the EIR?
It's necessary to have a site plan into the EIR so that the EIR can evaluate those impacts. Regardless of which path we go down based on the Kitchell analysis, we believe that this site plan can serve either project. It would just be perhaps be a smaller footprint, and we've directed our EIR consultant to not preclude either project when they evaluate the project.
So are we making an amendment to the amendment if we choose this other alternative? Because I thought we had given them a site plan with amendment 2.
We did. There are some slight modifications to that site plan, moving the location of the household hazardous waste drop-off site to be tucked in closer to the plant to reduce that footprint. So as they proceed through the site plan presentation, you'll see that minor tweak to the site plan. That's really the major change to that site plan, was moving where the household hazardous waste and the parking is located. I'm stealing all of Steve's presentation right now. The other half, next item, we'll talk about architecture, and I think we'll have more realistic architecture that can be included in the environmental analysis once you see this presentation, including photo simulations.
Well, let's go ahead and have an EIR
that we'll be presenting. As backdrop to that, we wanted to point out some of the considerations that we feel should go into the site plan, that we want a visitor focus, that when people come to the plant, whether it's the public to visit the plant or to go to the household hazardous waste facility, that they kind of know exactly where the plant entrance is and have a focus there. We also know that we're going to have a number of plant deliveries and hauling away of residuals, and we have to deal with the Atascadero Road traffic. So this is a copy of the plan that went into Amendment Number 2, and basically we had the household hazardous waste facility located here, which is in close proximity to where it is right now, right here. And I think there was some concern about the proximity of this to the road relative to the new plant. So what we developed was a second alternative that basically shifted the household hazardous waste from this location over here. It brought it back further from the road, tucked it in here, actually makes for a more compact arrangement, which we think has advantages.
I'm sorry, Mr. Hyland, could you orient us to the page? Where is Atascadero Road? And
oh, I'm sorry. Let me go back to the original one. Atascadero Road is running through here. The beach is over here. Highway 1's over here to the right. North is straight up. The high school would be over here. So the existing plant is right in this vicinity. This would be the maintenance building, operations building over here. Okay. And then, again, the existing household hazardous waste facility is right in this vicinity. And, again, there's really no change to the rest of this site plan other than moving the household hazardous waste facility from this location to this location. And it involves a little bit different orientation of the roads. But, again, it makes for a more compact site. And I think affords an opportunity to kind of move the household hazardous waste facility a little bit further away from the road. At this point, I might like to add a little bit to what Mr. Leibich said earlier. We present a site plan that's going to get embedded in the EIR, and it serves as a starting point, a basis for how they're going to evaluate the project. And this layout is subject to change. Some of these facilities may shrink in size, have a little bit different geometry, length-width ratio may change. I mean, that's all part of the natural evolution of a design. The idea here is to present the concepts, and within this framework, you can expect there to be changes, and that doesn't upset the process. That doesn't negate all the prior work. It's just part of the work. So as long as we're not shifting, you know, making major changes, all that is consistent with the process. So this is a change that, in my mind, is really pretty modest, but we wanted to show you what we could do to kind of alleviate some of the concerns that were expressed before. So this is what we presented at TAC, and I think there was a general acceptance that this alternative B, Plan B, would be preferred to the previous alternative. And if you concur with that this evening, then what we would do in our amendment number two, when we issue a final one, and we're holding off issuing that final until we get through the EIR process, then we would incorporate this plan as the site plan. But again, recognize that the site plan is going to be subject to some changes as we advance the design.
Comment? What impact, if any, since you've shifted the road on the right side of the page, has that on our yard or the concrete company?
This is part of the advancement of the design. This road here on the right, I should, along here, is this the one you're referring to, I think? Let me toggle back and forth between the two. You can see that the change in that road there is really pretty modest in these site arrangements. Now, I fully expect there's a chance that this road orientation may be one of the things that changes as we advance the design. For instance, we may want to relocate this further to the west and maybe use this corridor. A lot's going to depend on how the size of these facilities finally lands. Again, there's going to be iteration of this layout as we advance it. That's just the normal process, you know, normal part of the design process.
Did you answer my question? I didn't hear how it impacted the yard or the concrete.
Three-sided lean-to, and cars pull in and out of that. So there is good reason, like Steve was saying, as we move through the process to kind of refine that or to look at those impacts in terms of the city's yard and how to mitigate or minimize those impacts.
And I'll stop after this. My question was because it looked like the road got fatter on the west when you went from the hazmat to the left, the hazmat to the south. And so that's why I thought maybe it would create greater issue in the yard than the original.
And it won't be a, from what we're looking at, it's a fairly insignificant impact compared to the impact we're already having, I guess is the way that I would describe that. So you go, we're just sort of cleaning things and boxing them in a little bit better. That'll continue to happen, but we do have an issue of, are we going to impact the yard? Quite possibly. And you go, and then we also are impacting the concrete plant with a portion of this. So a portion of this plant is currently designed and configured, is going into the area in use by the concrete plant.
Thank you.
Yeah, questions. Curious to know why this isn't accompanied by some sort of cost analysis. It's really challenging to try to make a decision here to adopt one of these at all without having any sort of review or range of costs. The other question is, under site plan considerations, two of the real key items that we know are issues are the inherent volatility of the site for natural disasters and the floodplain, tsunami, and so on, but also reclamation. Those seem to be premier issues for us, for the longevity of the site, but also for any sort of coastal commission approval that we're going to be asking for. So I guess I'm wondering why that's not part of the basic site considerations when we look forward what we're planning on with our site plan.
The original layout we had here, all of the new facilities will be assumed to be built on engineered fill to get up above the 100-year flood level. One of the advantages of going to the next alternative is if you see this area right in here, this would require engineered fill to get this portion of it above the 100-year flood level. If we go to the alternative arrangement, this we wouldn't have to start ramping up. The engineered fill wouldn't have to start until right about in here and over here. So there's a little bit of a trade-off between the fill that you would have in this rectangle, if you will, versus some, a little bit additional fill along this edge. At a conceptual design level, this kind of difference is really pretty insignificant. It's the cost difference, if any, is not going to drive this decision. And so, you know, we just don't view that as being a major factor for this kind of decision. And then I think also, though, that you can see that from a flood mitigation standpoint, that this arrangement is going to have a little bit more impact probably on the floodway than this configuration. So that's another advantage.
And so just to confirm, though, when it comes to the cost of that fill and the impacts, because we are going to be receiving a proposal that isn't based on a campus-style layout, which is also going to be included in the EIR review, we're going to have the chance to actually contrast those two options, so we don't necessarily have to ask you to come up with an alternative to the campus style if our concern is the cost of that fill and the impacts to the overall project. I think I'm directing that more at Mr. Livick, just to confirm that we have some options built in to address that sort of a concern.
Yes. Regardless of which project is chosen, they're both going to be above the floodplain. They're both going to be built on fill. The structure for the consolidated treatment plant, their facilities needs to be above the 100-year floodplain, as with this facility. Now, there may be a reduction in site area and a commensurate reduction in fill, but that's a lesser environmental impact than perhaps than this is. So that has to be, when we're looking at the evaluation, that would also be considered.
I have some comments.
Comments over there?
I'd like to make a few comments. Number one, number three is your little box up there that's near the existing ocean outfall.
This one right
is
there.
That a physical structure?
That's an existing structure. That's an existing air release structure. Now, we haven't got that far in our analysis, but we may be able to eliminate this with the new plant hydraulic profile.
Okay. I just was concerned that if we could capture a piece of real estate that didn't have anything on it, at least on the surface, we might have something later that of some value. Mm-hmm. And I was curious whether that was a physical structure or not. Yeah. The portion of where you have the, I'm assuming, employee parking there?
Right in here.
And the hazardous waste. Is that an area that could be at the lower grade?
The parking definitely could be. I don't know that it'd be prudent to put the hazardous waste at grade, although there was some discussions with them about that, and the expectation would be that if you anticipated a flood event that would inundate this area, the household hazardous waste trailers would have to be immediately removed.
Okay.
and that's certainly an option. So if you went along that path, then the area of site fill could be reduced by, you know, right across here.
Okay, very good. It was just an idea as to where we make that drop-off and how we make it on that side of the plant.
No, those are excellent thoughts. And again, we're so early in the process here that these would be the kinds of things that, as we go through preliminary design, we would be evaluating those further and refining this. We know that we're going to have review and acceptance of any road access with the city, and we're going to have to work out what that's going to be. This curve is going to be a real challenge, and you know, I'm not sure where we're going to land here. Again, this is a concept. It allows the EIR process to go forward.
Okay.
Can I just ask a follow-up question on that? As far as the hazardous waste, is that something that you could just build the wall around, since it's the beginning of where you have to raise it? Would a wall be perhaps less expensive? I'm getting our engineer probably saying no.
That is possible. In our discussions with the IWMA, they seem to believe that the trailer that they have purchased for hazardous material storage is flood-proofable, that it comes with sealable vents, because they've considered in the manufacture of that trailer that it could be located in sites that are subject to inundation. They are getting us the plans for that, the unit that they store hazardous materials in, and so that we can make a decision whether it would be allowed to be in the floodplain or not. Okay. They also have a management strategy such that they can move all the materials stored outside out of the flood zone and to the facility at Cold Canyon landfill very quickly. So we're working with IWMA to minimize the costs of the hazardous materials storage relocation.
Thank you.
Okay, I for the sake of those who were not at the TAC meeting, these are the things, actually, we discussed this drawing at that meeting, and the TAC group felt that this was a better plan than the previous one, site plan A. So everybody should be up to speed with where we were at the TAC meeting, I believe, right now. We discussed one other thing, and I think that was the zoning. Rob Livick, you mentioned the zoning at that meeting.
Yes, the majority of the site is zoned M1. Which is light manufacturing, and we have specific general plan policies that allow the wastewater treatment plant to remain at that location. There's a slight corner of the property about where the existing admin building that is within the commercial visitor serving zoning, but for the majority of the site is zoned M1, light industrial type uses. There's an I overlay interim, which would allow for trailer storage to be on that site until till a project came forward that met the ultimate zoning. Unfortunately, due to its location in the floodplain, it would be difficult to construct something there and not
I can recall was that I did make a comment about the appraisals that we received earlier, and I believe they were based on what was called the highest and best use, which was the Sheraton Hotel down there and on that corner. I'm just joking. But I wanted to point out the discrepancy between the highest and best use zoning, if I can say that, versus the M1 zoning. So there will eventually need to be some clarification about the values and how that zoning affects those values. So that's something we will certainly discuss at a later time. Shirley, did I miss anything?
No, you covered it very well.
Thank you.
Since we were supposed to give direction tonight, I'm wondering, in addition to hopefully approving this site plan, I agree with your comment about using the road that's on the jointly owned property. It would be a lot easier all the way along the line. So perhaps if we're all in agreement on that, we would ask that road be moved to the jointly owned property.
My only question would be, would it not already be moved if that's the way they could design it?
All right, I'll ask.
That's Steve's question.
Yeah.
Well, we can design virtually any road configuration that is going to be acceptable to everybody. I think, and Rob probably can weigh in more on this, but EDA, our surveyor, will be surveying the parcels that make up this site, and I think there's going to be some subsequent negotiations about the property ownership and all that will come into play, and I think that's going to influence where we route roads too. So again, it's just another example, I think, of the iterative process that we're going to be going through as the design advances. I think it's very difficult to pin down exactly where the best location for that road is at this time, but it'll eventually evolve, and it's going to be one that satisfies the traffic considerations and one that satisfies the property ownership considerations.
Okay. Well, I think we at least have agreement that we'd like to see it on jointly owned property.
Sure. Okay. That makes sense.
All right. Anything else on this? Nope. All right. Let's move on. And next is consideration and discussion of the architectural treatment for the upgrade project.
Do you want a motion to approve one of the two plans?
I think we're just receiving and providing direction. So,
but we haven't given direction if we want Plan B or the alternate.
Do we need a motion, Mr. Carmel?
Yeah.
It always helps clarify staff's okay. and the designer's job if there's a formal motion.
Okay. All right. May I hear a motion approving? Is anybody going to make a motion?
Sure. Move approval of Plan B alternative for the
All right. Any more discussion?
I'm kind of confused, but I think I have to vote no. I still have overriding concerns about the site and the impacts of the site from natural disasters. So I'm going to vote no because based on those concerns.
Okay.
For what it's worth.
All right. All in favor?
Excuse me?
All in favor?
Yes,
go ahead before we vote. Yeah.
In that motion, do you wish to include moving the exit road from the corporate yard
I
over
did,
to the
yes.
other side?
And, that was what I was trying to
And consideration
move
just to move that other entry road to the south side of the current administration.
I was trying to move the road.
All right, so both of those roads.
I would like to amend the
changes.
Motion to include making the changes to the
roads. Okay. All right. And
Second.
You agree with that? Okay. Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, 4-1 with Mr. Smuckler opposed.
Okay, Cayuca, same motion, please.
Same motion with amendments as Morbey.
Second. Motion and a second. I'd just like to clarify that on that other entry road that we talked about, south administration, it was to include consideration. I'm not trying to tell you where to put your road. Just they might think about it.
Well, again, I think what I'm hearing is this is the preference of the JPA, which is good input. I think as we advance the design, there may be other compelling reasons why we end up with roads in different locations or having different points of access to the Atascadero Road.
Yeah.
So it's just something I would caution you that you know, again, traffic's going to have to weigh in.
Well, and that was one of my biggest concerns, that we're casting concrete here all of a sudden, and I believe Noah's no vote was discussing that, so I appreciate those comments. So, any other comments?
No.
All those in favor signify
aye.
By saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries.
All right. Moving on to consideration and discussion of the architectural treatment.
Paddle fall.
Okay, great. Right. Thank you.
Okay. Again, for background, we met on August 19th. The first segment of slides that you're going to see are the same that we presented at the TAC meeting. Since that meeting, Pat and his crew have been able to advance some of the concepts that we had there, and he's got some 3D and photo simulations that I think you're going to find pretty interesting. And so, again, out of this, we're trying to seek some direction for the architectural options that we can continue to move forward with. I wanted to identify some of the challenges we have at this site. You're normally looking for visual compatibility with the adjacent land uses, but we have quite a smorgasbord of uses here. We have the high school, a concrete batch plant, trailer storage, a campground, beach access, household hazardous waste facility, and maybe there's some other future facilities. So we need to take that into account. We need to be concerned about the views from public spaces like the highway, Tascadero Road, public entrance. We have zoning restrictions right at a setback from the property. We're limited to 30 feet in height. That can grow to 45 feet as you move farther back with approval of the Planning Commission. This may or may not be a big issue, but do we want some architectural compatibility with other public works facilities in the community? You have a courtyard, the city hall, community center, fire station. They all have different architectural treatments. Is there any kind of linkage that's going to be desired there? Some of the more practical things is this is a marine environment. We really want to move forward with cement-based products, nothing metallic, looking for durability, low maintenance. Cost, obviously, is an issue. Whatever concepts we advance here are going to be put forward in the EIR process. We need to get acceptance of that. Public perception. You know, we're sometimes caught between we want the most economical appearance and then we want something that really looks good and makes the community feel proud about. Well, those aren't always, you got to have some flexibility there. And then, obviously, there's just the functional requirements of a treatment plant. It's a working facility. We're going to have staff there, O&M activities, truck traffic. So all these things are factors that we're trying to take into account. I'm moving ahead and stealing Pat's thunder. At this point, I want to say that I think what caught everybody's attention was kind of the austere, plain, vanilla appearance of the facilities that we presented in Amendment Number 2. And we did that intentionally in my direction because my concern was at the time that I didn't want to overpromise something architecturally that we may not want to deliver, that there may be more expense involved or maybe there's a different approach people wanted to take. So I wanted to advance something that was as plain as possible and not cause any concern that we were overreaching. As we've talked about it, I think we need to advance it further. We need to show a little bit more. I think it's going to be needed to get acceptance with the Planning Commission. And so Pat and his crew have developed some concepts here that will show more color, show a better context to the facilities. And so I'll turn it over to Pat now, and he's going to kind of walk you through some of the architectural aspects of this that he wants to bring to your attention.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Hello, everybody. My name is Pat Blody. I'm an architect with RRM. And as Steve mentioned, the first part of this slide presentation is revisiting the concepts. They're really preliminary concepts that we shared with the technical committee. And the second half of the presentation, I'll show you some really interesting 3D images that could be included with the environmental impact report. Now, this first slideshow we included, I just wanted to give people some background on architects' thinking when you're going into a project. There's some you want whatever project you're designing to fit within the context of the neighborhood. And so like the blue box says, successful building design usually begins with selecting some forms that are compatible. And so there's some, just for food for thought, there's contemporary building forms on the upper left. There's traditional building forms on the lower left. There's more industrial building forms on the lower right. After viewing the siting and viewing the surroundings, it would be our recommendation that we consider more industrial building forms. They seem most compatible. And in addition to some parts of virtually every plan, I'm told, that are not going to be that attractive. And this is, that's what this slide is all about. Okay? The next few slides are labeled cost considerations. We thought it would be helpful to talk about a range of costs and how architectural treatment would affect those. And at the lower end, this happens to be the Santa Paula building. As I mentioned, it's very modest in terms of architectural treatment. There's very simple forms. The materials are cost-effective and durable, but there's not a whole lot of articulating, projecting details. Then if you move up the cost scale a little bit, this shows a two-story office-type building. Doesn't have to be a treatment plant. But this is probably in the middle range of a cost scale for architectural treatment. It's got the same simple building forms, but it's starting to add a mix of colors and surface textures. Already you're improving the public perception there. And then somewhere at the upper end of the scale, again, this is a slide that MWH provided. It is a built facility, right, Steve? But you can tell by the complex forms and the really interesting architectural features that there's going to be a certain premium you pay for this kind of interesting architecture. And then at the technical committee, we just threw in sort of a smorgasbord of different architectural types to solicit feedback, and I think that was pretty successful. There's a couple slides here showing different treatments. The third slide is much more traditional styles, not that we were recommending these. We just wanted to have them available for discussion. Okay? So that sort of concludes what we shared with the technical committee. The next slide Steve shows this is the existing facility, of course. Everybody's familiar with this. And for comparison, we took the initial concept building design that was in Amendment Number 2. And as Steve mentioned, it was pretty modest. It was toned down. It was strategically low-key. What the architectural team did is we took that very same building design and we started to enhance it with colors and textures. So you can see now we've got two different types of masonry. And then we started to add some proposed site enhancements, for instance, a trellis and a site wall. And as we shared multiple images of that same enhanced architectural treatment, you can tell that people were shocked and a little surprised that that was actually the same building design that we had in Amendment Number 2. It was just a matter of improving the colors and the presentation technique. Okay. So moving on, since we were able to meet with the technical committee, we've had time to develop some much more comprehensive 3D images of the site and the buildings themselves. The process for that usually involves generating a 3D model of the site and the buildings. That's what this slide represents. You can see on the lower left, that's the admin building. There's some treatment structures on the upper half of the slide. And there's also, you can point out the maintenance building there, and then an enclosure for the, what is that area, Steve? Residuals facility.
Excuse me, could you show me where the RV park currently is, on which side of this slide?
I think the next slide will clarify that.
Oh, okay, cool.
Because in the process, once we generate a model, and so that's a computer-generated model, then we're going to integrate that model with a true view of the site. So this is the basic aerial view that we started with. This wasn't a helicopter shot. We found this on an online website with coastal photographs. And then the next slide, this is a typical format for an EIR analysis. You can see how it's set up with a before and after format. On the left, it's called existing. We'll zoom in on this in a second. And on the right is proposed. And on the lower right, there's a map that indicates that yellow triangle indicates your point of view and how it relates to the red site itself. And I can see people squinting because that's very difficult to read. But if you zoom in on the proposed overlay, you can see how the site fits in on the actual aerial view there. So, correct. Now, that's been the artist has taken the existing part of the plant and sort of revegetated it in sort of an artist's vision of what would be there. Also, in the spirit of environmental impact reports, we understand that you need to slide, Steve. You can see there's very little of the plant visible above the existing foreground. So that's essentially a preview of how this project might be rendered for the environmental consultant to reach conclusions about the design and the architectural treatment. This last slide is what we'd like to finish with. We'd really like to hear your feedback from these decision makers on whether we're heading in the right direction. Again, we'd like to remind you this is a very preliminary concept, probably further developed than we'd like to be at EIR level, but we know how important the architectural treatment has become as a discussion topic. So we're hoping we're heading in the right direction, and we're anxious to hear your comments.
Could you make a comment about how tall that building is and how much all that glass costs compared to a not so much glass?
Well, everything's relative. So it is, first of all, it's a two-story building by program requirements. So the operators need to be on the second floor to oversee their plant. They don't have that current program requirement met right now.
But is that a 30-foot building, a 45-foot building?
That is approximately 32 feet to the parapet. So again, we're preliminary design. We're gonna do everything we can to keep a two-story building in a short profile for lots of reasons, mostly because it's going to be reviewed by the Coastal Commission. Now, the cost of that glass is no more exorbitant than any other two-story office building, and I don't think I can address that until the building is designed exactly how much the cost per square foot on the window will be.
But in general, concrete's cheaper than glass?
A solid concrete building would be much cheaper than a building with windows, yes.
But it'd be a little hard to overlook the site.
You at the TAC meeting, you gave us some kind of an estimate on cost per square foot on a building.
Yes, and
site.
I was scolded severely for that because the buildings haven't been designed. I think we could talk about those in generalities again. I think this building that we're looking at is a two-story office building without the interior improvements could possibly be built in the $140 to $160 square foot range. Steve, coming more from the public bid world, think that's a little ambitious. Now, that wouldn't include the special features inside the building, like the lab components and the special equipment.
But I thought at the TAC meeting we said something about $180 a square foot. And, frankly, in this building environment today, we're building homes for $250 a square foot and up. Mm-hmm. And I was very comfortable at the $180 level.
Well, I would hate to commit to those kinds of cost per square foot ranges at this early stage. I think we'll definitely be working with MWH when the cost estimate comes in, and we'll get those refined at that time.
I had a comment, which is similar to the one I made at the TAC meeting, too, that the materials hopefully would be things that would blend in with the dunes, with the beach, the colors and sand and sky and all that to make it less noticeable,
right.
Basically. The other thing that, and I know that there's a component here for use of the recycled water, but I also think that it might be good to not have a lot of greenery, to have some water features perhaps to use the water, but again with gravel or stones rather than a lot of stuff that has to be watered if we have better uses for it elsewhere in the community.
I think that's a good comment. And our firm is going to be responsible for the landscape design and will be sensitive to what can survive there as well as what looks appropriate in terms of landscaping. This looks like a generic landscape that you might see in any business park, and that's probably not what we're going to end up with.
Okay. Other comments from Morbe?
I was going to say we have a great tree list you can choose from. I would be more inclined to want to see, if we're Tree City USA, I'm not as interested in the multicolored facet of the design versus just a solid design, but the water feature where you can use recycled water off the plant, off of the grounds in a reuse. But I just as soon covered up, some of it with trees than worrying about the other for screening.
Other comments?
I just wanted to echo that. Obviously, the site, as the creek and the floodplain, is part wetland, so that would be a really important component as a theme for the landscaping. My question is more about the elevator comment you made. You said that's a requirement, is having the two-story and then thus an elevator as part of the project.
Well, the program, as we understand it from the operating staff, is that they need to be above the plant to observe the daily operations.
But that's not a requirement. It also provides options for passive solar lighting and so on. So I wouldn't consider that frivolous. And any sort of water feature that manages water from the site or perhaps is utilizes some educational component is definitely going to be better than something that's just there as a fountain to not really provide anything other than that.
A question, too. Is this going to be green? Is it going to meet green standards?
Well, what we can commit to is that your design team includes a number of LEED accredited professionals, and at the appropriate time, we're going to be making recommendations for the buildings and for the site improvements that will improve the sustainability. And I already heard one mentioned is daylighting for the office, natural ventilation, energy-efficient mechanical and lighting systems, plant materials that are drought-tolerant. There's a whole range of ideas that we'll be proposing throughout the design process. And in my opinion, it's safer to leave those out of the EIR and keep reassuring the board that we're going to consider those throughout the design process.
Well, I was thinking of the RRM office, which is very green element
focused. Yeah, I appreciate
focused,
that.
So, okay.
Last question in relation to the second story. My assumption would be that that would also increase the cost for load-bearing fill underneath and that we'd be looking at a more considerable expense for that element of the project given a second story.
That's a question for a structural engineer, and I'm really not prepared to answer that.
My experience on that would be this, compared to the other structures, particularly hydraulic bearing structures like the oxidation ditch, secondary clarifiers, water bearing structures, those are really what's going to control the engineered fill that's brought on the site. This is a relatively, compared to those, it's a very lightly loaded structure. It's not going to drive any decisions about our engineered fill on the site. It'll be on a pounds per square foot basis from a structural design standpoint. It'll probably be one of the lowest loading structures on the site.
Could I ask our plant operator, Bruce, what is the advantage of that second story?
I think you get a little smaller footprint overall. Whatever the office, the floor space you need, you're going to get, whether it's a one-story or a two-story building, based on the floor plan that I've seen. I think it gives you the advantage of, as Pat pointed out, that you can observe the whole facility from that building. When we toured Ojai has a kind of an overview of the whole plant from the operations building, so you could kind of oversee what was going on or who was on site just by looking out that part of the building.
Okay, thank you.
I have a process question in relation to some nuances as the project and the buildings are refined more. When it comes down to a decision about size of workspace or laboratories and so on, that's not something we're dealing with tonight, but we will have the chance to look at those costs impacts and make some decisions with real numbers that that can help us if we need to control costs further or reduce it to a minimum or increase it to something that we think is more expensive, but we make that decision with those information. That's not something that's on the table tonight. It's just all architectural treatment.
I would agree that's a normal part of any administrative office design, as well as other buildings that my team will be involved with the maintenance building design and part of the residuals facility. So that design is going to evolve, and you'll be seeing more and more detail as each level of design develops.
Okay. Well, I guess I just want to say that I would rather have a one-story building than a two-story building. It's on the beach. I don't know. The few sewer plants, the wastewater treatment plants I've been to are not two-story. You know, Pismo, San Luis, and I think it's. I'm going to assume it's more expensive to do two-story. Maybe it's not, but with all the space we're saving, as you could have seen in those previous pictures, there's no lack of space to make it one-story. And I just think it's an appropriate location for a two-story building on the beach. And I would also say no trees. When you look at the trees that do grow along our beach with the strong northwesterly that we get, you look at the trees up at North Point, they look awful. They're scraggly. I wouldn't put any trees down there.
I'd agree with the one story also, but for a different reason, because the elevator is a big initial cost, but you have the annual inspections, which are really expensive, that all these things have to be done.
Half a level up with some architectural character, basically.
Somehow it looks like we're looking for functional and unobtrusive.
My personal opinion of the architecture is that it looks like a pillbox. It doesn't look much better than what we had before, except it's got two colors now. And I agree that it, all of the costs associated with having a two-story building are probably not relevant. It looks like all of the layouts have been done, assuming that we've done Site B. Is that the site plan?
These are all based on Site B. That's correct.
Yes. Yeah. So it points out that it appears that there's been a decision made in the TAC committee on a direction to proceed. That before, because when it's brought to us for decision making, the site selection, even though we just voted on it, was really decided at the TAC committee, and you've been proceeding on that.
But we're being asked now for our input on the preferred architectural style. It hasn't been decided. We're being asked.
Site B was a recommendation by the TAC committee. That was all. It was just a recommendation. And we just had
and we saw all these same
and
things.
And I didn't see anybody objecting to Site B, so maybe somebody should have objected to Site B, and we could have proceeded from there.
Okay. All of these architectural treatments could be adapted to either one of those sites, by the way. And not to confuse the issue, but this is actually the same building design that was proposed in Amendment Number 2 with some site enhancements. And as I took away from the meeting, there was a lot of consensus that this was an improvement over what they saw in the Amendment B, and that was basically the direction we kept going. So,
I don't think that really, of all the styles that we've considered, I don't really see where that fits into the slide of the architectural styles to consider. Is that the beach? Is that the sand dune motif?
That is not the sand dune motif. And I'm glad you brought that up, because there was some discussion at the technical committee. Well, why don't we go off in a different direction and look at a building that's sort of a stealth building that blends in with the landscape? And I researched that, and my team researched that, and everything we came up with was a single-story building with almost no windows. They looked like bunkers, essentially. So we thought there was a fundamental conflict with what the operators need and with that architectural style, and we didn't pursue it at that point.
I wouldn't say not any windows, because it'd be a shame to have your workplace on the beach and not be able to see it. So I think that's
daylight, right.
Right. I think that's real important, but I think it's not necessary to be two-story to have that.
I'm okay with single story, but it seems to me that this is such a personal kind of thing. Each person has his own attitude about what looks nice or what should fit. I'm okay with single story. That works for me. Can we make the bunker look nice with some windows and other embellishments? Perhaps so. But it sounds like there are more people thinking, gee whiz, maybe it's too costly, and it appears like we're squandering our money to go two stories.
I'd like to comment. First of all, Pat, I think you did a real nice job, and thank you for listening to us at the JPA and then bringing all of that and a lot more here this evening, so that everybody got to see, surely, if I'm not mistaken, what we saw at the TAC meeting, plus all of these other slides that Pat has done. Actually, I'm quite pleased with where you've gone and what you've put together for us. Two stories, if that makes Bruce's job easier and the staff out there, I think that's important to them. I don't have a problem with that. I'd like to back up Steve Hyland, if we could. Let's go back to the Santa Paula plant for just a moment, which I'm sorry is quite a ways back. Santa Paula plant, just go all the way back to the start. Okay, there's my when you talk about landscape, and I enjoy the little trees along the curb there. Sometimes I think that's what people think landscaping should look like. And Pat, I appreciate the trees and the lawn that you put on the other one. Thank you very much. Go ahead and let's move from there, Steve. Keep going. Oh, there it is. There's the, what did you call it? Pat called it a trellis. And there were we. Oh, this one. Okay. We discussed at the TAC meeting about, you see the trees in front of the parking area there. And the concept was that the property forward of that toward Atascadero Road eventually could be something usable to the city. And we wanted to, in fact, screen the industrial portions of the plant and make it not so concrete in your face looking. And I thought Pat did a nice job there. Also, with the administration building, having said that we're going to spend $30 million to get this thing done, or 28 or some number, and having said that $180 a square foot is a bargain in today's market, I think that the appearance of the administration building, which is where people are going to arrive to see their new treatment plant, is a feature that we shouldn't just neglect or try to make it go away. As far as the two-story and cost, I think you're only pouring foundation under half of it. So sometimes you can gain a financial advantage there that might work for you. I think you should keep that in mind. But I like what Pat did. Frankly, I like the trees. I question what tree will grow in salty sand, but maybe we can work on that. So I just wanted to say that to let everybody know that Bud's right. We all have a different opinion about what we think should be done. But I thought Pat did a nice job. Thank you.
I would just like to comment that I really like it, too. I think it's a nice layout, and I don't have any objection to the two-story or the trees, for that matter. I think it's very attractive. But I would ask the question, since this is a conceptual design for the EIR purposes, if we showed a two-story, would we be tied to that with the EIR?
I think I should. I could answer that, but maybe Rob could share his experience.
Thank you.
Well, a one-story building is going to have a lesser environmental visual impact. You're not going to be seeing it as much. There may be more of it across the site area, but it's not going to be as high. So I think our
EIR would be safe in showing the photo sims for the two-story building, and then as the site design gets refined, if it ended up being a one-story building, it would may have a lesser visual impact.
I see. And I think it would be less of an impact on the footprint, too. So I like the two-story, personally. I think it's a better thing, and I think Bruce had a good point of being able to see the entire plant.
Pat, this would be the outline of the two-story.
Yeah, Steve's pointing to the profile of a two-story admin building from the coast view.
And it certainly doesn't impact the area.
It certainly bears more pros and cons discussion, one-story versus two-story. There's cost benefits. There's operational benefits. There's perception benefits. Anytime you have a gateway to a public facility that clearly identifies the first-time user where you go, I think there's a good benefit there. So I don't think that decision needs to be made tonight. We could defer that. And like Rob says, the EIR, if it shows a two-story, that's worst-case scenario, and you're covered for either way.
But I would like it noted that I think a majority said they'd like a one-story building as modestly, and that it was a visual impact.
I'd like to add something on that discussion, and that's that often in our planning discussions we talk about having not a box and that the second story might be a little bit smaller and the first story a little bit larger so that you would still have that visual ability without as much impact for people looking at the site. So if there's that sort of a compromise, because I do understand the advantage of being able to oversee the whole plant, I think that that is something, even if it's maybe a little just an ability to walk up on the roof and see it, that might satisfy that. And I don't know if that would require an elevator or not.
I don't see this as a visitor serving.
No, I'm not talking about
I know that you're not, but I think that goes back to the concept of the two-story. This is a sewer plant. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's a wastewater treatment plant. It's not a place where we're going to bring our visitors to come look at.
Right.
It's a utilitarian thing, and I think what you're hearing from Morro Bay, and it is located in Morro Bay, that we'd like to see that as a one-story. And Cayucas,
I'm from Morro Bay,
live here.
And I'm thinking not necessarily. So what I'm saying
but
is that I think there's
it.
Room for options within the design, and I would like them to come back with those options. I don't want to limit it.
We probably shouldn't get too into this at this point, too, especially considering the Planning Commission is going to have a lot of influence.
Right. I also like to point out,
usually with a constrained site, we don't have room for ramps and
nightmare.
Those types of gadgets. The elevator is the cheaper solution.
Okay, so a motion. Just like we did on the last one, direction to staff.
So I'd be glad to make a motion about the direction that we're headed, is that we would like for it to blend in with the beach. I like the beach thing, that it be one story, and that it'd be modest. I'm not looking for fancy.
I'm going to vote no, because I don't want to limit them to one story.
A motion.
Oh, God. Do I have a second on that motion? Okay, motion dies for failure, for lack of a second. I'll try a motion. I think that I would like to move that we approve the general concept. We would like to see a one-story option, and if that is more feasible, to go that direction and to make it very much blending in with the beach look. How's that? You have a second? Okay. Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? None. Okay. Cayucas.
Cayucas, same motion.
I make the same motion as our mayor.
Second.
Motion and a second. Discussion? My only point of discussion is what is make it blend in with the beach look. I'll go back to the slide that I pointed out about the Santa Paula treatment plant. Landscape, if you will, along the road, and the beach look out there is pretty weak, in my opinion. If it were a little nicer, maybe you'd have a little more traffic down there at the end of Atascadero Road, but I'll support the motion for the sake of Pat being able to move on and Steve with their job. Any other discussion?
No.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Motion carries.
Okay. All right. Moving to our final item. I'm sorry. Item C5 has been pulled from the agenda. Item C5 has been pulled from the agenda. We did not get that report. So our last item is to schedule our next joint meeting and future agenda items.
I need to clarify.
Excuse me?
I just need to clarify.
C5 has been pulled from the agenda.
Did you vote no, Mike?
I voted no.
He did.
Okay. So for the record, we have one no. Thank you.
C5 was pulled from the agenda.
That's been pulled.
Okay.
Well,
to another meeting.
Okay. All right. We did have some future agenda items that have come up. The one that I would like to suggest is that we...
Ms. Peters, yes. We probably should provide the public, at least the majority of the board, a statement about why C5 was pulled. There was a lot of interest on the public's behalf.
I'd like to know that.
To Andrea, can you, or Bruce,
it wasn't ready,
that?
I guess.
Knowledge. Okay.
Hello. We just received some information from MWH on the cost estimates, and it's very involved, very detailed, and of course, it's a very critical issue. The cost estimate. So staff and myself have not had an opportunity to go through all of that information. What we'd like to do is bring it back to you at your next meeting in October rather than try to force it on tonight without having really given it enough examination and evaluation.
Thank you.
My recollection is the last JPA meeting, we tasked the staff to provide us with the cost estimate in as much detail as they had at the time. That's all that we asked for. That doesn't, even if that's only four numbers, that's what I asked for and wanted to know. And it's very upsetting that it's taken 2 months and we still can't get that information.
And I would totally concur. This is the one thing we asked for tonight, not the other items that we've dealt with tonight. And so for Montgomery Watson to have gone off on these other items doesn't feel like you're following direction, because what we really wanted was numbers tonight. And you've had 60 days.
And it isn't Montgomery Watson. If they weren't able to do it, then we just put in whatever number we know in terms of construction cost. All I wanted to know was what, at this moment in time, is our best estimate of what Plan A is going to cost us.
To tag on to that, I also was very interested in preliminary estimates about operations and those costs projected out as well, considering what's happened with the projections.
All right, Rick. Okay. All right, so we've got that one resolved. Future agenda items. The one that I heard is we would like to review and define the task of the TAC at this point. And
I can't hear her.
Do I have agreement on
the that? Initial TAC?
Whatever it is now, I mean, whatever the initial one was may have morphed into something
but
else.
But I'd like to know what the initial one was.
Okay, so we need
and
to discuss.
And at what points it changed.
We need to discuss the definition of the TAC task.
I would support that.
Okay.
Along with that, definitely Mr. Foster's concept of the Citizens Advisory Committee that's focused on the financial and risk implications. Help us evaluate those components.
Excuse me, I wanted to have two separate committees, a financial and risk assessment committee and a Citizens Advisory Committee that would be under the direction of Dennis and help Dennis in his public relations effort. Other tasks.
So we can agendize and discuss
yes,
that.
Yes, I'd like that agendized.
All right. We still have our rules for how we agendize things. I'm not in favor of that at this time. I think that's premature to form other committees.
But what are the rules for agendizing?
We have to have three of us agreeing.
Okay. Do we have three to agree?
No, I'd like to see what the task force is. Guidelines are going to be first and see what is and isn't included in that. before we make more committees.
Just a confirmation, though, because time is of the essence, wouldn't we want to have that come back to us? So
my vote was no. Thank you.
Okay, so that's...
I'd be opposed to any more subcommittees or committees.
Okay, I'd like... Could somebody clarify as an agenda, you know, how the membership on the technical advisory committee is composed, and how and when that comes up for appointment or election? Or
we can have all that in the report on the TAC committee.
Okay,
that, that's
thank you.
Fine. Yeah. Okay. Anything else?
I'd like to. This is an agenda item, but I guess I'd like to see the bylaws for how this board operates. And if we're actually operating as separate bodies, which I think we are, then it doesn't take three people to get something on the agenda. We would use the rules that we have for city council, which is it takes two people to get something on the agenda. Which means if Mr. Smuckler and I would like to hear the committees be on the agenda for next meeting, then that's should be sufficient.
It takes three, and otherwise you write your own report.
Right. I'd be glad to write that report.
All right.
So I don't know how they agendize for their board.
I have
no idea. And if they can hear what we hear, even if it's not on their agenda.
We have what we call Cayucas rules.
We noticed.
And if you come to one of our meetings, you'll have a much better understanding of what that means.
All right. Then I'm going to ask Mr. Carmel, I mean, what do we do now? We've got one board that doesn't want to. Our majority doesn't want to. Where are we? I'm sorry?
It sounds like there's not consensus to place them on the agenda.
Okay. We need to have you say that in the microphone. I'm sorry.
We don't have bylaws. It sounds like there's no consensus to place the items on the agenda at this point in time.
Okay.
Then I would like to agendize a committee to write bylaws for this board, this body. Because if we don't have rules, we're making it up as we go along.
But that's, okay, the whole agreement, that's what the TAC's trying to do, is get the agreement set out.
But does the
so
agreement
let,
talk
let's,
about
let's
agendizing
let's get that
things?
Report back and talk
go
about
on,
it
Jim.
Then.
Does that agreement, I'm just asking, I need to know, does that agreement talk about how the meetings are run?
I don't know, will it?
No, it doesn't talk about
I don't
how to
think so.
Agendize. It actually predates most of that.
Right.
It does set forth a process by which you vote on anything, and,
mm-hmm.
and that is 3 and 3, and that's the only governance section in the agreement.
So we can add a section to that with regards to how our meetings are run.
Amend the JPA?
Yes, absolutely.
Certainly something else we can put on our plate.
I thought that's what TAC was doing anyways, was amending the JPA.
The TAC is going through the JPA, yes. So let's get that report, and then we can talk from there.
Then how do I bring up my agenda item, which is to talk about public comment and how we can rearrange that at these meetings so the public's more involved?
Tim, come up for the Brown Act.
Where did that come from? I'm sorry.
I'd like to respond to that. I know that at times, and I'm not sure, maybe Tim can help me with the rules, but at times we will discuss a topic, and then we'll open it for public input, and then we'll...
You don't allow public comment on other items. And so I would really like to have a consistency between whoever's chairing.
Did you want me to weigh in on this one? We've, you know, Madam Mayor, we've actually debated this many, many times over the course of the last few years. We interpret the Brown Act, or at least I interpret the Brown Act, and the provision requiring public comment as the comment is before or during each item. So you have a general public comment session that doesn't deal with agenda items, things that are not on the agenda, but within your subject matter jurisdiction. And then with regard to each individual item, and again, I know Morro Bay doesn't do it this way, and I'm not suggesting that it need to, but before each individual item, public comment is taken on that item, and it ferrets out comments that are related to agenda items, and it facilitates a better discussion. And that's the way we've always done it. And frankly, it's the way I've done it in the dozen or so agencies that I've represented in the past 25 years. And I think that's what that gentleman was mentioning. We've thought about this before. I know Rob is very adamant that the wording in the Brown Act, which says every agenda for a regular meeting shall provide an opportunity for members of the public to directly address the legislative body on any item of interest to the public before or during the legislative body's consideration of the item. I've always read that as applicable to each individual item. So that's what the debate's about. And again, I'm not suggesting that Norby needs to change its procedure, but that focuses the issue directly on what the Brown Act is intended to do. And I know we do that in Cayucas and always have, and I just wanted to sort of get that out again. We've had this debate before. I know you probably remember. So
we have, and it's become a very difficult
issue. This is
issue.
Your jurisdiction, so I don't pretend to impose what I believe to be the plain wording of the Brown Act on Morro Bay.
Well, the reason that I said this very specifically today is that you could comment at the beginning of the meeting on anything on the agenda. If we had left this open, it's now 10:15, if we had had public comment on every one of our six items, we would not be halfway through the meeting. So there's got to be some cooperation between what we have to accomplish and what the public weighs in on. And I know you're very frustrated, but there would be 10 other people still here for every item, too. So you figure we had half an hour of public comment at the beginning on each of these items. We could have had another half hour, and we would not be finished. So I'm happy to have that discussion if you want to have that discussion. That's fine. We can put that on the agenda for next time.
But you need a majority of us to say that we want that. You can't just put it on.
That's true. Okay.
So I agree to that.
Carla? I didn't say I wanted to.
Just make sure we only have two items on the agenda every meeting.
Right.
And a lot more meetings.
And Ms. Peters, don't you need the other side of us?
I haven't even got three here yet. I can't see Rick and Carla. Rick, do you want this on the agenda? Okay, that's three. All right, we've got three here that want it.
Put it on the agenda.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, so that'll probably be an attorney report. Okay. Anything else? Anything else?
Just to confirm, we have added the itemized invoices and charges to our report, so we'll actually see that. Great. And then our next meeting is in Cayucas. We're close tonight, and definitely at other meetings we've been surcharging on our capacity. And I know it makes Mr. Livick uncomfortable for just legalities there for fire safety and so on. But also it's not right if we do have a meeting and we have members of the public having to stay out in the corridor. So I just hope as we go forward we recognize that. I don't anticipate we'd have that problem at the Cayucas Vets Hall, but next time we come to a meeting here, we should really weigh the capacity and the anticipated participation or at least attendance.
Doesn't that sign say 250 people?
Yeah, we could easily have put some more rows of chairs in.
I just wanted to recognize that.
So I'm sorry number 251 had to stay outside tonight.
Yeah, I guess that would go pretty well with our public relations program.
Are we done?
So what's the date of our next meeting?
Good question.
November 14th?
October 14th?
October 14th.
That's what somebody said. You did.
If somebody has a calendar, it's the second Thursday.
Which is the 14th? Okay, October 14th. In Cayucas.
October 14th,
yes.
Right.
And that's in Cayucas?
Yes.
Is it the Vets Hall?
Yes.
Okay. All right. With that, we're adjourned.